This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Donald Homuth. Today is 13 April 2016. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. Homuth is joining me by telephone from his home in Salem, Oregon. Don, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some background and biographical information from you. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in what was then called Fort William, Ontario. It's now called Thunder Bay, on the 22nd of May, 1944.
And what were
you? I am by an inspection, not a baby boomer.
Okay. What were your parents' names?
My father's name was Donald Carl. My mother's name was Lois Thelma Brigham. They were both native-born Canadians and Canadian citizens who were later naturalized.
Okay. Well, what did they do for a living?
My father and mother were both ministers in the Salvation Army.
Interesting. How did they get into that line of work?
I have the foggiest idea. I wasn't around.
Right, right. You mentioned that they became naturalized citizens in the U.S. When did they make that move?
You know, I don't have the exact dates. It would have been sometime in the mid to late 50s. Certainly, my father was naturalized before he died in 58. My mother was naturalized, I think, shortly, either just before or just after that.
Do you know what necessitated the move?
Yeah, the Salvation Army sent them from Canada to the United States.
Okay. All right. Well, Dad, tell me about the kind of work they did with the Salvation Army.
My earliest memory is my dad being, you know, working in one of the local churches. But later on, in about 52, when we moved to North Dakota, he became sort of a fundraiser and coordinator of the church's efforts in the rural parts of North Dakota. That would be the counties that didn't have what they call a citadel, which everybody else would call a church. That would have been in the rural areas of North Dakota and western Minnesota.
Okay. Tell me about your childhood growing up. Where did you grow up with these moves that you would make? Because I know that you went from Canada to Minnesota for a short time, then to North Dakota. Tell me about growing up.
My wife is of the opinion that that's an ongoing process. but certainly from early childhood, Fort William, Ontario, Selkirk, Manitoba, then to Owatonna, Minnesota, which was my first introduction to American life and American schools, and then to Fargo, North Dakota in 1952, and I stayed in Fargo for the next roughly 28 years.
Okay. Well, what was life like for a kid making these moves at that age, going to school, doing the things that you're doing?
Disruptive to a point, but you know, it's just like Army brats. I suppose I was an Army brat. It's just like the kids people in the service. You move from place to place, and it's just a normal part of your goings on. Then once we settled in Fargo, from 52 to 58, you know, Dad would go out on the road 4 days a week and come back home. Mom was a stay-at-home mom. I did all the things that kids did in the 50s, largely left alone, trusted to play on my own. I did a bunch of nerdly things that other kids didn't do. Like, if I remember, one year I decided to read the Webster's Unabridged Dictionary all the way through one summer, and I did. And another summer, I think the following one, my folks had bought a copy of the World Book Encyclopedia, so I read that. But, you know, I bicycled, I played, you know, sports in summer programs. I was a Cub Scout, a Boy Scout, and an Explorer Scout. Pretty much a normal kind of upbringing. It wasn't too bad. We were by no means well off. Salvation Army officers aren't. But we were okay.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any siblings?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, as I'm fond of saying, I have an overbearing mother. I was the oldest of four boys, followed by a girl, by my father, and then after my father died, my mother remarried. There was another girl, so I'm the oldest of six kids, one of whom has since died.
What about schooling? there in Fargo. Can you tell me about that?
Roosevelt Elementary School, which was about a block down the road, down the street from where I lived, was just sort of normal school. It had the normal kinds of teachers, most of whom seemed like they were ancient. I was a mildly precocious kid, so I was forever getting into interesting sort of difficulties, but nothing mean. I would cause turmoil, but I wasn't disruptive or, I wasn't a juvenile delinquent.
Mm-hmm.
I just did a lot of sort of weird stuff. I was sent to typing school between fifth and sixth grade, so I would type my homework, and that caused the school to be very, very bothered because they didn't know any other kids who typed, and they thought I was cheating and having my mother do it for me.
Mm.
But no big deal. I mean, it all worked out.
Yeah. Can you tell me about growing up in North Dakota during the Cold War, with the Cold War as a backdrop? What sort of things do you remember about that?
Well, we had a number of things. We had, two missile air force bases, one north of us about 80 miles at Grand Forks, and then one across the state northwest at Minot. So early memories involved things like B-36 bombers, the big 10-inch, the six pistons, four jets flying across. I remember early on in Fargo, the National Guard was flying P-51 Mustangs, which was way cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then later on, they graduated to various of the early mid-50s Air Force throwaway jet fighter planes, which was also way cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then every now and then the Air Force would fly first the B-47 and then later B-52s across. And that was always cause to go running outside and look at what went on and get all excited. I was seriously into airplanes as a kid.
Mm.
So and next door to the school was what was then called the Ground Observer Corps in an old school building. And that just seemed terribly military, so I would go out and hang out in there. They more or less tolerated me, but, I learned about how aircraft were tracked, and until they finally disbanded the Ground Observer Corps because it wasn't fast enough to keep up with modern strategic aircraft. But it was a neat place to go,
mm-hmm.
And I got their two handbooks on how to identify airplanes basically from over the late 30s, well into the 50s, and maybe even early 60s. And I've maintained that. That interest in aircraft and airplanes has been maintained. Although I never did become a pilot, and I always dreamed of being one, but that's
right, right. What about the Cold War in general? Do you remember any of the specific incidents, whether it was Korea or any of the multiple other...
One of my earliest memories of reading a newspaper was reading contemporary accounts of the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And being terribly fascinated by what it was these people were doing. Although, to be really quite honest with you, I was more taken up with the stories of the aircraft, the B-29 raids, the MiG-15s being introduced and shooting them down. I'm still very fond of the MiG-15 as a thoroughly lovely little airplane. The F-86s coming along later, and the dogfights, and I would pour over the dogfights. So I remember Korea fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
The Cold War itself was always there, but it was always sort of subsumed into normal living. We were aware of it. We did the duck and cover raids, or as we used to say, even in elementary school, get under your desk, put your hands over your head, tuck real hard, and kiss your ass goodbye.
Right.
Because we all sort of knew that if an A-bomb went off in Fargo, it would just take the place out. It wasn't very big at the time. It was only about 36,000 people.
Hmm. Tell me about high school.
High school was more interesting. That was when I was able to finally sink my teeth into real academic subjects, and I took to it like a water. Enjoyed it. Was considered a bit of a nerd. And I am a bit of a nerd. big sports, but I did manage to get a letter, a high school letter, in intramurals of all the crazy things. And it was the only one that had been given out in like the previous 5 years. Intramurals requires you to be acceptable, if not proficient, in a number of activities that people would consider things in sports. So things like archery and ping pong and bowling and all that sort of stuff. And if you were good enough in a number of things, you got a letter, and I did. But, you know, that was when I got into my first serious girlfriend relationship. That was good. And it was, as I'm fond of saying, I didn't so much lose my virginity as I exchanged it. And that was really good. And my first girlfriend, the great love of my life at the time, and I have maintained a good friendship ever since, even though she went off and had life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it was a good thing, and I liked it a lot. I had good teachers. That was the thing that I recall best. I had stupendously good teachers. They were really good. They knew their stuff. And that was at a time when Fargo was funny. Fargo Central High School wasn't, sports elite. It was academic elite. And so we took some considerable pride in that. So, for example, I was one of the National Merit Scholarship finalists in 1962. And everybody thought there were only, there were seven of us in the high school. And that was considered pretty cool.
Yeah, that's impressive.
People thought that was neat. On the other hand, I have no idea who the quarterback of the high school football team.
Well, life's a series of trade-offs, Don. You mentioned that you had really good teachers there, and it was a good program, and you're really getting into it. What sort of topics or what sort of subjects did you gravitate to?
Well, obviously the sciences, biology, physics, and chemistry. Those
mm-hmm.
were great. One of the great formative teachers I had was a Marine Corps veteran named Richard D. Olson, and he taught world history. And that gave me an inkling that history was perhaps something other than a recitation of the dates of elections and wars.
Mm-hmm.
That there were social movements about and things were happening, and there were revolutions, but they had reasons. They weren't just, things nowhere. I had the usual difficulty with mathematics. I struggled with that all my life, but I think I finally got it years later. Sometimes I'm a slow learner, most times not, but it was difficult to get a grasp on some of that. But, very active. I mean, I was active in the drama club and the speech club and the plant science club. And, well, Lord knows what else.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it. What do you remember what you wanted to do once you finished high school? Did you have career goals in mind?
Yeah, I wanted to be a scientist.
Is that right?
I didn't much care what kind of scientist. I just thought being a scientist would be way cool. Like, wearing the white lab coat and doing science things. I liked the discipline of the sciences. And so when I went to college, I started out as a botany major, keeping up that plant science interest I'd had when I was in high school. I did a project my senior year, radiation-induced mutation in strains of Himalayan barley. How's that for?
That's a mouthful.
That was a mouthful. And I had written to, Livermore National Labs and some other things to get barley irradiated by gamma rays and neutrons and whatever. I mean, this is pretty heavy stuff. It was good enough to get me an award in the Westinghouse National Science Talent Center. So, I was seriously into that and thought that was just very interesting and wanted to do that.
When did you graduate from high school?
I should have. I graduated in 1962. So
okay.
If you ask where was I in 62, I was in Fargo, North Dakota, graduating from high school.
All right. Now, obviously, 62, the early 60s. I mean, this is the age of Kennedy, as short as it was, I guess, is one way to look at it. What do you remember about Kennedy? What was your thoughts on him?
I was a Nixon fan. I thought that Kennedy was all very interesting, but he seemed to me like, at the time, like a flash in the pan.
Mm-hmm.
He was a, what's the term they used later on? It just didn't appeal to me. But, you know, did I admire him? Oh, yeah. I mean, kids admired presidents then. There being at least no known reason not to.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody had savaged them, although I understand that some people tried at the time, but it was like no big deal. I liked his style. I thought when he went to Germany and did that Ich bin ein Berliner speech, even though a Berliner is a form of pastry. nevertheless, I liked the fact that he was getting out there and saying, hey, this nation identifies with other people, and keeping in mind that Germany in 62 or so was still recovering from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It was by no means rebuilt. So when he spoke about that, that struck a chord that I thought was very good and a good stance for the nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you graduated at a time, I guess just before the Cuban Missile Crisis, October of 62.
Well, yeah.
Do you remember that?
I remember it very well. The Air Force deployed a unit of, let's see, were they interceptors? I don't really recall, but they deployed a unit to the municipal airport in Fargo, Hector Field, and they were flying all the time, and it was ongoing and ongoing and ongoing, and we were glued to the televisions or the radios to say, what is it that's really happening? And the idea of an imminent nuclear attack was very real.
The next question, obviously, is November 22nd, 1963. Of the assassination of Kennedy. Where were you, and what do you remember about that?
I remember it vividly. I was in my apartment. I was going to college. It was a basement apartment, not basement, but a garden level. And the news came across the radio that Kennedy had been assassinated. Well, first that he had been wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Turned on the television and saw, you know, the running of the cars and all that stuff. Finally got the news from Cronkite that he had died, and I just absolutely hollered. My memory is that I not so much screamed, but it was one of those God damn it things. I don't remember if I put my fist into a door or not. The flashback of that is vague, but I didn't break down and cry. I was furious, and then I watched the whole thing later on as you know, Lloyd would be killed by the assassin. It was an awful day.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I had friends of mine that were breaking down, crying in tears, and calling the phone and coming over. What are we going to do? We're going to get on with it. That's what we do. So.
Yeah. What kind of impact do you think that had on the country as a whole?
Did it have? Boy, not for me to determine, other than one of complete shock. I did not get the sense at the time, or at least my recollection is, that it brought the country together. One of my early memories of that is how people were then started to just start to rag on Lyndon Johnson, even though, shoot, the guy stepped into a total clusterfuck. He had a... He had an administration of people who actively did not like him, and yet he was supposed to run a nation, and it was important that the nation be run. So what did it have? Well, all kinds of impact. The Civil Rights Act of, what, 64 or 65, that was obviously an homage to JFK. It was him that put it forward. Robert Kennedy, you could almost sense the hostility JFK. But in terms of the country just sort of said, you know, what is it in that English sign, keep calm and carry on.
Mm-hmm.
We got on with it. You know, the things that JFK had been had been doing, LBJ continued doing. So there was a sense of continuity, if not coming together.
Okay. You graduate in 62. Where did you go to school?
To college, I went to North Dakota State University in Fargo.
Okay.
I had been accepted at numerous other places, but I couldn't put together a financial aid package that would actually allow me to go to school. Although God knows I really wanted to go.
Yeah.
The place I wanted to go to was Michigan State, but I wasn't within several thousand dollars of being able to do it. So I went to North Dakota State right in town.
Well, tell me about your time at North Dakota State. Tell me about the academics, about the environment there on campus.
The early on, I sort of divide this into two main sections, 62, 63, 64. Normal freshman, sophomore stuff. I took a bunch of advanced placement courses, which essentially made me a sophomore by the end of my second quarter. Was cruising along and attending to my studies. I may as well say it, having a great sex life with my girlfriend, but in some ways not. I didn't join a fraternity. I never did take up college drinking the way some did. It was going along pretty well until sometime in like October or November of my freshman year when I was driving my very first car, a BMW Isetta 300. Little bubble car with the one door that opens out front. And I got hit from behind and it broke my neck. So I was in a four-poster neck brace and taking pain pills, and I had a 7:45 class in the morning.
Wow.
And that was kind of a struggle. really an uphill slog. Came through it okay. Not brilliant by any stretch of the imagination. It's difficult to think. That went all right, and then the following year when I finally got past the neck problem, that was all very well until my then steady girlfriend for the previous 4 years decided to seek her fame and fortune on the stage in New York and up and left. And that was a trauma. That was really a bother.
Yeah, no doubt.
So, I was so bummed I went skiing neglected. Withdraw from my classes. So I just went out west and never went back.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Where did you go and for how long were you there?
Oh, I wandered around all over the place. I landed in Eugene, Oregon, where for a while I worked on a logging crew for what was called a gypo logger. That's a fancy term for timber thief. And then I worked in a plywood mill. Net effect of that was to convince me that all of that talk I'd been reading about manual labor being a good solid American virtue was a lot of crap. And it was less the labor, which was bothersome enough, but more the people that I had to hang around with because they were people I worked with. And so to hell with it.
Yeah.
So, and in the meantime, apparently the draft board had been sending me draft notes, and I knew I wasn't going to be drafted because I had what is now known as the Russian lymphatic deferment. I had pilonidal cysts, and those were a direct bar. Once the military knew about that, you would not be drafted before I. But, you know, rather than actually deal with it, I just didn't. So eventually I got a call from friends in Fargo when I was in Eugene saying, there were a couple guys here from the FBI looking for you. So.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was considered a draft dodger. And I suppose I was, even though it was perfectly clear I was not going to be drafted. I mean, I knew that. That was a dead, rock-solid certainty. Trust me on this. If Rush Limbaugh wasn't going to be drafted, I certainly wasn't, and I didn't even know about Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah.
But in the fullness of time, I went back to Fargo, and an number of things happened. One of the things was I reported to the draft board and said, hi. And they said, where have you been? Oh, here and there. I've been out, what was the phrase at the time? Looking to find America.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, we were going to get the FBI after you. And I said, oh, crap. You already did, and I know that. But the problem you have now is I have voluntarily reported before they found me. So what do you want to do? And they said, well, we think you should take a draft physical. And I said, when? And the guy said, well, we would do it this afternoon, but it's a little late. How about tomorrow? I said, fine. So I reported my draft physical the next day. And then did an interesting thing. Part of going through that press is there's a time you'll find this in the Alice's Restaurant Massacre song that was popular at the time. But they ask you if you ever had a criminal record. And I don't know why I did this, but I made one up. I fundamentally ran myself off as a real badass. So they sent me in to see a psychologist. The psychologist was a medical service corps second lieutenant, not much older than I was. And I gave him my best James Dean interpretation. And he decided that I was just, what was the phrase? There was a phrase at the time for Army recruiting, if you're good enough to get in. And he decided I was bad enough to stay out.
Hmm.
So about 6 weeks later, I get a draft card, and it's 4F. Curious about that, so I called them up and I said, can I just think, was it the broken neck? They said, no, all that stuff is fine, but you were considered morally unfit. Seriously.
Wow.
Now, fun part is I carried that draft card with me all the time I was in Vietnam. And I got more free drinks out of that in the NCO club than you can believe.
Yeah, I'm sure you probably pulled it out at every opportunity.
Every chance I got.
Yeah. Well, that is really interesting. When did you go back and take your draft physical? What year was this?
That would have been about 65. Sometime, probably March or April of 65. I had enrolled in summer school back at the university again. And again, back in sciences, although I had switched to biochemistry at that point. And also had a part-time job at the radiation metabolism.
Yeah, it kind of got you at least baby steps toward what you thought your ultimate goal would be.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Now, of course, here we are in early or spring of 65. This is not where the story ends, of course.
Oh, no.
So there you are part-time at North Dakota State, lab tech part-time in 1965. What's next for you?
Well, I decided that chase a childhood dream that I would become an Air Force officer.
Mm-hmm.
So I signed up with Air Force ROTC on the school and did all the appropriate Air Force ROTC things. And I was coming up on my junior year, and it was time for me to switch from the basic first 2 years, which is to the advanced ROTC program. So I signed up for that, and the Air Force, being the highly regarded, highly ethical, highly moral group that they were, discovered my moral unfitness to be drafted.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, first they discovered the pilonidal cyst, because I had to tell them about that. And they said, well, you can't be in it if you have those. So I had them operated on and taken out. And so that got rid of the medical problem, and then they discovered the moral unfitness problem, which was always a falsehood. But it's very difficult to go before an Air Force colonel and say, but they said, well, do you have all this criminal record stuff? I said, yeah, but I lied. You lied to the draft board? Of course you lied to the draft board. Everybody lied to the draft board. So they finally, in the fullness of time, decided I was morally unfit to become an Air Force officer, because my moral fitness would sully the officers, probably. And so they said no. But the Army was perfectly happy to take me. I switched over to Army ROTC, but not for very long, mostly because, to be quite honest about it, the people teaching the classes, doing all the stuff, were about the dullest people I'd ever met.
Hmm.
So I decided probably sometime in the summer of 66, I'd heard about the Army Warrant Officer like training, and thought, hey, I could become.
And there was no problem with either the broken neck or the spotty record of what you said to the draft board? This is no problem?
This is 1966.
Okay.
And the Army wants reasonably conscious, if not morally perfect, pilots to fly helicopters. So, yeah, the Army had no problem.
Mm-hmm. So, helicopters. This is a far cry from the... jets and the fighters and things that you had seen growing up in North Dakota.
Well, you know, I mean, one thing after another. Helicopters were cool, but they weren't as cool as a fast mover jet interceptor.
Mm-hmm.
Although I never really wanted to fly those, I really wanted to fly the C-5. But the Air Force had those, and there was no way the Air Force was ever going to take me. So the next best thing was the Army. So they offered this warrant officer flight training program. That was cool, so that's what I enlisted to do.
And you finished your degree there, I assume, then?
Oh, no.
Oh, you didn't yet?
No.
Okay.
That would have been... I was coming to the middle of my junior year when I enlisted.
Let me ask you about your mother. You said that your father had passed away in 58. What does your mother think about this record that you are creating for yourself here?
She doesn't know about it.
Hmm.
I thought highly of my mother, but I never thought she had any business knowing everything that was going on in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know.
Even when you went walk about there or ski about for a while?
She had no idea where I was.
Is that right?
Yep.
Hmm.
I didn't talk to anybody back home. It was kind of like, my girlfriend left me, I'm seriously bummed. I'm not going to talk to anybody, to hell with it. And I just went off on my own. Almost a year.
Just kind of disappeared for that time then.
Yeah, that's why the FBI couldn't find me.
Yeah. Hmm.
As a matter of fact, every time I got a draft notice, I moved.
All right, Mr. Holmuth, you have, you've done it. You've signed up for Uncle Sam.
Yeah.
It's 66. What's the next step for you?
Let's see. The next step was to go to Fort Polk, Louisiana, by way of Dallas, and I was able to, one of the things I do remember, and I still think of it as an interesting thing, there was a little thing called Texas Airways that flew from Dallas to somewhere near Fort Polk, and it had one of the last scheduled DC-3s acting as an airliner in the country. And I recall that the stewardess was very small, when we got to altitude, she passed out chewing gum, which is like something out of the 30s. But got to Fort Polk, and I'm in basic training.
Tell me about basic training at Fort Polk. This is a far cry from Fargo, North Dakota, or where you've been living for most of your life up north. Fort Polk is it's a different animal altogether. Tell me about basic training down there.
Basic training was, for me, in some ways, a bit of a skate. Having been a junior in college, and having been on the both the Air Force and the Army ROTC drill teams, the marching part was no problem. I knew it very well. In fact, knew it better than probably most of anybody else did. And so they made me a squad leader. The three stripes on an armband thing that some of the people got to do, which relieved me of things like KP. So I didn't have to do any of that. And there were a number of things that, you know, I had some responsibilities to the squad, to the, like, you know, 10 or 12 guys that I was supposed to take care of. But by and large, it wasn't all that bad. My problem is I had gone in as a bit of a lard-ass, and getting whipped into a reasonable shape was not an easy thing for me. It was an uphill climb. You know, mostly it was okay. Some of the stuff was hilariously funny. There's one incident. Well, let me take you to the first day. I had been told by friends of mine who've been in the Army on that first day, when you get there and your first formation, line up, standard attention, pick a nail on the wall and look at it. Don't take your eyes off it. And they'll leave you alone. It worked. I just stood there, just still as a stone, and looked at that damn nail, and it was fine. So a number of things went along, and whoever the guy, you know, the cadre looked at the 201 files, which indicated, oh, pretty good scores on their tests and 2.5 years of college. And, you know, so I eventually get appointed as a squad leader, which was kind of a neat thing. The funniest thing that happened in basic training, we had a drill sergeant. Falvey. Sergeant Falvey! And he was tall. He was crew cut. He looked a little bit like James Coburn. Had that same sort of voice.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody feared him to no end. My problem is I was old. I was 22. I wasn't 18 or 19. And I'm looking at this and saying, they've only got me, you know, for a certain amount of hours in a day. There's not a whole hell of a lot they can do. And I know part of the deal is they're supposed to break you down somewhat psychologically. And once you know that, at least for me it didn't happen, but there was the incident where we were going to go out to the rifle range to qualify. And Sergeant Valby says, anybody out here, you young people, think you can beat me on the rifle range? You can't resist that challenge. I said, I raised my hand. Full move! Sergeant Tully, sir. He said, do you think you can beat my score? Absolutely. I didn't know if I could or not, but I don't care what the hell. It was important, at least for me, that if they were going to challenge, that someone should at least rise to the challenge.
And these are M14s, right?
These are M14s.
Okay.
So we went to the rifle range, and Falvey says, what do you want to bet? I said, name your bet, Sergeant. He said, I'll bet you a good cigar. You're on. So we went to rifle range. I did not beat his score. So we return, we clean our weapons, we turn it back into the armor and all that good stuff. And I report to the first sergeant. Private Holmuth requests permission to duck the first sergeant. What do you want, Holmuth? I said, first sergeant, I bet Sergeant Felby a good cigar that I can beat him on the rifle range. I lost the bet. I'd like permission to go down to the main PX and get him a good cigar. And he said, okay. So they gave me a pass to go to the PX. Greatest thing that ever happened. Nobody got a pass to go to the PX. So I went down to the PX, and I can't remember what it was. I hung out. I had a hamburger and french fries. I went to the library. I pissed away the whole afternoon. Finally bought him a good cigar, caught the bus back to the area, and reported back. By that time, everybody had gone home. But, you know, so, yeah, did I lose the bet? Sure. What did it cost me? A couple bucks. But what did I gain? I had the whole damn afternoon off. And so, you know, I always figured I came out ahead of the deal. Falvey always made a big deal of losing the bet, but I always just sort of kept it to myself that, yeah, I might have lost the bet, but it was probably worth it.
Well, tell me about the training there.
Pretty basic training.
Mm-hmm.
You do a lot of running, you do a lot of marching, you do some shooting. We did a bivouac, and it was a strange thing. It would have been probably sometime in October, and I had done thing that was probably illegal. I had smuggled in a transistor radio, so I was getting weather reports. And the weather reports said that while we were on bivouac, it was going to be a frost warning. So I made sure that I had stuff to layer up with, and because of my involvement with Boy Scouts, I knew how to sight a tent and how to, you know, make sure that it didn't get, you know, too cold and wasn't out in the wind and all that stuff. So I made out like a bandit. Matter of fact, my tent was camouflaged so well, it was in the well of a southern longleaf pine that they couldn't find me. let's see, we woke up that morning, the cooks had overslept, there was no hot food, but we had a great group of guys in that particular training company. So we were out there at 0600 and got into singing. And it moved the captain. What was his name? Eric Faberg. Aberg, something like that. It moved him to tears. So he ordered up some trucks and took everybody back to the main area for hot food and showers and all that kind of good stuff. And I overheard him talking to the first sergeant saying, I've never seen that level of morale in any basic training group ever. So that, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But there was one unfortunate thing that happened. I had an E5 drill sergeant, one of those junior drill sergeant types. And boy, he took a dislike to me. And so it came time for pugil stick training. I didn't really know what pugil sticks are.
Sure.
Supposedly it's to teach you the fine art of using the bayonet, which is a lot of crap. Mostly what it is just the means of just beating the crap out of somebody. And I was okay one-on-one, and I was okay two-on-three or three-on-two. But he put me up against 2-on-1 against a couple of guys from the south side of Chicago. And boy, I tell you what, they were good. And they managed to, one of them caught me under the chin just as the other one caught me in the back of my head. And I was out like a light.
Hmm.
And so I'm down on the ground, I'm unconscious, the drill sergeants are all panicking. I think I'm out for maybe 20 seconds, but it was enough. Because that disqualified me from going to warrant officer school.
Is that right?
The Army has a regulation that if you have any period of unconsciousness, you may not fly for 6 months. That was the end of it.
That must have really been a blow to you.
It was. It was terrible. And had I known then what I know now, I could have gotten out. But I didn't know then what I know now. And so they offered me just a tremendous deal. They were going to send me to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and make me into a mechanic. Want to be a mechanic, but they had my body in, so they sent me there. And so I went to Fort Rucker, Alabama for what was AIT. Most people talk about that, advanced infantry training. It's actually advanced individual training. And I started aircraft mechanic school and did well. I mean, I think I was top of my class in aircraft mechanic school, but I was asked in one of those evaluation sessions, you know, so what do you think about this, da-da-da-da-da, and I said, I hate. I don't want to be a mechanic. I don't want to be any of this stuff. It just is not what I had in mind. And so they didn't send me off to the next advanced school. They just sent me to Vietnam.
Let me ask you here. What did you know about Vietnam? This is 1966. The U.S. has been involved in Southeast Asia more generally for quite a while now. And we have troops on the ground. Marines go in 65, troops there earlier than that, advisors, of course. What did you know about what was taking place in Vietnam?
Well, you know, by way of prologue, I had followed the Vietnam War from the 50s.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah, from the early 50s. I recall the newsreels in the movie theater talking about the French, you know, battle and subsequent defeat at Dien Bien Phu. I also followed the negotiations, that there was going to be an election and, you know, the country was going to be divided. Then there was going to be an election in, what, 53 or 54, and it was going to reunify the country. I remember John Foster Dulles and Eisenhower saying, we're not going to do that. You know, yes, we agreed that there would be an election, but we just discovered last week that we're going to lose. And so we're not going to do that. There will be no election. There will be no reunification. And to my way of thinking, that's the start of the Vietnam War. You can argue that we started earlier than that when we flew combat support for the French. But, and in fact, you can argue that we started under Truman when Ho Chi Minh asked Truman directly, saying, look, we've been on your side all during World War II, and we don't want to go back to French colonial rulers. And we would like very much for you to recognize our independence. Said, no, we're not going to do that because the French are our buddy and they get you back whether you want to go back or not. So that's the start of the French war in Indochina. Bung Minh Jap, arguably one of the best generals in the last half of the 20th century, basically beats the crap out of them, just defeats them cold, runs them out of the place. And then the U.S. steps in and picks that up under Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles. So, you know, did I know? Yeah, I knew. And did I see it as it ramped up during Eisenhower's time? Yeah. Did I see it when Kennedy, you know, sent in the Green Berets as advisors? I'd heard enough from people then, like that. These were fighting advisors, these were combat troops. Then as things escalated, they just did. Now, I was as outraged as anyone else was at the, what we now know, ginned up Gulf of Tonkin incident. And I thought, well, you know, like, geez, we ought to be able to knock these people over in no time at all. How dare they shoot at a U.S. destroyer? It did not occur to me at that time that that this nation would, I guess I have to use the term, that this nation would lie about it. I used to think they didn't lie, that they just made a mistake. But in order to lie, you have to know the truth and then contravene it. And I used to think they didn't know the truth, but now I really think they did. And in fact, I did. I have believed that since.
So you're aware of what's going on there.
Absolutely.
And like you say, you're aware of the Tonkin Gulf and what was going on there and the advisors and all this sort of stuff. So what was your opinion of it? What was your opinion of American involvement and the growing involvement there? Is this something that you thought was a good idea? Wasn't? Where did you stand?
Well, like I told you earlier, you know, I would have been considered, if you would have used these terms, a bit of a conservative Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes a bit of an anti-communist. And still I'm not all that fond of communists, but there's nothing we have left anymore. So I thought, yeah, you know, it'd be a quick in, quick out. You know, we'll just settle their hash once and for all and leave. It did not occur to me that it would go on for years.
Did you have any idea of how the U.S. was prosecuting its part of the war? Time?
I'd have to say advisedly no.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was an unconventional war, that we weren't going to get a set-piece war. With, you know, armies amassed on the field, and, you know, I'll line my guys up and you line your guys up and we'll have at each other. I knew it was not that. But it seemed like a small deal. It just didn't seem like all that big a deal at the time. World, one of two, what I, not even super, but hyperpowers, could knock off, you know, an indigenous army like that. Yeah, it seemed like it should have been okay.
So you're finished with your AIT, Fort Rucker, in January of 67, according to the records that you sent me.
Yep.
They tell you immediately that Vietnam is the next stop for you? So
it was not like it's an issue. We're standing on a, you know, an assembly area at Fort Rucker. People are being called out for various things. Some people are going to Germany and some people are here. But there was no question in my mind it was heading for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. So you get the orders straight out of AIT then?
Yep.
Do you head straight to, say, Travis sort of flight out, or do you spend some time at home? Okay.
Yeah, I went home first with my mom, of course, all misty-eyed, but we had pictures taken, all that sort of good stuff. It was a big thing, my friend. You know, be sure you come back home. Yeah. You know, keep your head down. Yeah. You know, just the usual sort of trite phrases that you hear before you get shipped out.
Yeah. How much time did you have at home before you had to ship out?
I can't remember. I think it was about two and a half weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I was supposed to go out of Travis at Oakland. So, you know, and it's December, so I get to spend Christmas with my family. I recall that. I think Christmas was at the beginning of the leave. And then toward the end of it, sometime in January, I have these orders to report to Travis and be prepared to be shipped out. So that's what I did.
You knew about the war, your mother, family members are giving you the advice that they can give you. But what about you personally? Are you reticent about this? Are you anxious about this?
None of the above. In my family, of course, back in Canada, both of my grandfathers had been in the Canadian Expeditionary Force in World War I. At least one uncle, no, two, one on my mother's side and one on my father's side, went to England and France in 1939. So there had been kind of a tradition in the family, although not in the U.S. side of things, because it wasn't the U.S. side of things, that people in the family go to war. And it was I nervous about it? Not particularly. Was I excited to do it? Not particularly. Was I excited about what I was going to have to do? No, I was downright depressed. I was going to go to Vietnam and be a helicopter mechanic, and God, I did not want to.
Yeah.
But, they got you by the short hairs. So you go. So I went.
Okay, you've got 2.5 weeks or so. You eventually got to make your way out to Travis. Tell me about that experience, and tell me about going from Travis over to Vietnam.
Spent 4 or 5 days at Travis, I think. And part of it was interesting. I learned quickly how to get out of doing things. I noticed that the people who were in charge of the transshipment pretty much changed every day. So every day when we were called out to do police call or whatever it is we were going to do, I would tell them I lost my dog tag. So that I would then have to report to get new dog tags made, which I didn't. And so I would basically just wander off and go to the library and hang out. Avoid all that make-work stuff that they got into so much of. And finally, my name gets called up on a roster and says, you're going to go to Vietnam and you're going to fly Saturn Airways, which, if I remember, was owned in part by Lady Bird Johnson. So we're going to fly to Vietnam. And we're going to, it's going to be Hawaii, Midway, Guam, Philippines, Vietnam. And we're flying on a four-engine piston plane, a DC-6 or maybe a 7, and somewhere midway between Oakland and Hawaii, the air conditioning on the airplane failed. So we've got we've got like however many stinky soldiers inside. It was pretty crass, but I actually got to touch base in Hawaii, which was kind of neat, and Midway, nobody goes to Midway, and I got to stand on the soil of Guam. That was interesting. And I was at Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, and a couple of friends of mine from high school were there, so I called them up on the phone and we had a nice chat. And then finally into Vietnam and into, if I remember right, Long Binh, and then to the 93rd Replacement Depot at Long Binh, one of the worst awful places I've ever been to in my life. And I hang out there for like 3 or 4 days waiting.
What was the atmosphere like on the plane ride over, or plane rides?
In all honesty, I don't recall. I think mostly I slept. My usual defense mechanism in times of personal stress is to say to myself, I think I need to take a nap. So I suspect I mostly just slept, and other than the takeoffs and the landings, I don't really. In terms of what were the other people doing, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I had nothing to talk to them about, and so I didn't talk to many people. I have no memory of that at all.
Okay. Well, you come into Vietnam, Tan Sanut, I guess.
No, this was Long Binh.
Okay.
Or Binh Hoa, probably.
Flew into Binh Hoa.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, give me your first impressions of Vietnam when you step off the plane.
It smelled terrible. And I learned later that was because of the the practice of burning shit. People would go to the latrines, they would crap into a 55-gallon bucket that had been cut in half. Those were then hauled out to some place, throw in some GP4 in the match, and they burned it off. But that was overwhelmingly, when I got off the airplane, it was this place smells terrible. And it did. But keep in mind, Long Bin Binoy was a huge complex.
Mm-hmm.
And with that many people out there, you know, crapping at regular intervals, there was a lot of shit to burn. So in retrospect, it's not too surprising, but that was, I can still smell that smell.
So you head to the replacement battalion. What's
battalion,
like?
Depot, right?
Yeah, the 9th Rebel Depot, yeah. Tell me about this place. What's going on there? What are you seeing? This is a new experience for you.
Yeah, it was tense. It was cots without mattresses. It was a formation in the morning, a formation in the early afternoon, a formation in the evening. And you waited to hear if your name was called out. And it was, you go to this line, and you go to this line, and you go to this line. And there were trucks that were hauling most of the people off. And my name just never got called. But 3 or 4 days into this, I get called, and there's no trucks. And there's I can't remember exactly what the transportation was, but anyway, I was taken to the helicopter pad and flown off in a helicopter. So I was taken to Fuloy from Long Bin by my first ride in a Huey.
The first ride in a Huey must have been something else for you.
Yeah. I kept thinking to myself, geez, you know, if I hadn't been knocked out basic training, I could be flying this thing.
Right.
And I thought that was kind of thrilling. And it was my first helicopter ride, my first time in a Huey, the whole nine yards. And I do recall, though, once we got up to altitude and looking out over the country and thinking how astonishing. All those rice paddies and the rivers with the trees around them, and thinking, you know, this is actually kind of a pretty place, except for those big holes in the ground. But that was a kind of a pleasant trip. I dreaded getting off the Huey, but the Huey ride itself was an innovation.
You've been assigned to the 11th Combat Aviation Battalion, correct?
Yep.
All right, and that's based at Fuloy. Tell me where Fuloy is. Tell me what Fuloy looked like.
If you go roughly 40 miles, 45 miles northwest of Saigon, there's an area up there, an area of considerable unpleasantness almost down here in the triangle.
Mm-hmm.
Fuloy is an old Japanese airstrip, located at the southern point of that triangle, almost exactly on it. It's very near to bad guy country. It's flat, it's dusty, it's hot. But it was at the time, I was told anyway, the largest helicopter unit, or a helicopter base. And it had at least 5 or maybe even 6 aircraft units on it, plus engineers, and there was an artillery unit and some other stuff. So it's fairly large, and it's all built around the airstrip and the tarmac, the pads and the revetments. It's got huge, big, basically orange colored from the dirt. They probably had been olive drab at one point. Canvas hangars to do helicopter maintenance work. It's got rows of revetments, fundamentally just big barriers to park the helicopters in. It has cantonment areas for, you know, to keep the people who actually live and work there. It all depended on who you talk to. If you talk to the people who are out in the field, It was the closest thing to Shangri-La. If you talk to the people who were up at Long Bin or down in Saigon, this was out in the wilderness somewhere, and you were basically at the whim of the enemy and the elements.
Mm-hmm. A lot depends on perspective on how you perceive that.
Yeah, it was a decent enough place. I mean, we had an EM club, and where you could get a cold beer and soda or, you know, whatever, and mess halls and hooches to live in and all that stuff. So we were by no means in the field, and we were not at that point living in the Canvas Army tent like so many people were.
Mm. So you're with the 11th. Take me to, you get off the helicopter, you're going to report in. Take me on that little journey for you.
Walk about 200 yards across the airfield to the door of the battalion, and there's a guy there to pick up our orders and our files and whatever it is that we're with. I plunked my duffel bag down. It's blazing. Sitting there, and I don't know that I've ever been more depressed in my life. Here I am in goddamn Vietnam, and I'm going to be assigned to a maintenance unit, and I'm going to do work that I hate doing, and damn it all anyway. You know, I never should have got my cyst taken out, and I should not have tried to enlist. I'm having recriminations with myself, and just, it was in the parlance of the time, a complete and total bummer.
The good news is it's only 365 days.
Well, that's you know, only 365 days. But 365 days is a very long time when you're 20 years old.
Absolutely.
And I remember just thinking, ah, crap. You know, the next year of my life is just going to be awful. I don't think I used the term sucked because I don't think I knew it then.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had known it, I would have said that.
Yeah.
And then a miracle happened. And the miracle's name was Private First Class Victor Berry. And he comes out of this door, looks around and says, "Which one of you guys is Homan?" He raised my hand. He said, "Come with me." So we go into the battalion headquarters, which is in the shade, and it's cool. And I'm sitting with Vic, and there's a couple of other guys. And we have this interesting little interview. And it says, "We've been going through your 201 file, and you've got pretty good scores on your tests, so you're reasonably bright. And you've got a couple of years of college, and that's good. The big question is, seriously, do you play bridge?" And I didn't know that that had been the first question that anybody had asked of Vic. And I said, "Well, yes, I do." And I said, "What conventions do you play?" I said, "Well, I can play Gerber, I can play Scheinwald, and then I have a convention of my own that I invented that I call Flugenscheiß." And one of the guys just about fell apart laughing. He knew German. And Flugenscheiß, of course, means flying shit. And so "What does that mean?" I said, "Every now and then, just for the pure hell of it, I'll throw in a bit and make a potential." So, I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been Vic who said, "Well, here's what we do here." And they explained to me the duties and all that stuff. Oh, yeah, the second question was, "Do you type?" Yes, I type. I had learned how to do that when I was in elementary school. Show us. So they hand me this Underwood 5 typewriter with the keys blacked out. And so I typed. And it demonstrated that I could type. Said, "Okay, here's the deal. This is what we do. And you were assigned to it to be a mechanic. Do you want to be a mechanic?" As I recall, my response was not only no, but hell no. "Would you like to be a clerk?" And I think my response, at least the one I remember, was, "Who do I have to kill?" And they said, well, one of our guys is rotating out, and he's the fourth in our bridge group, and you look like you'd be a suitable replacement. So if you'd like to be here, we'll assign you here, and you don't have to go to one of the maintenance units and look after companies. And that was good. So I became clerk.
It's all about timing, huh?
It's better to be lucky than good.
And, of course, we should mention that Vic Berry conducted an interview with us here not too long ago.
And that was the first time I learned that his first question was, can you play bridge?
Right.
So, yeah. And by the way, Vic and I Vic was my best friend when I was a kid. And some years later, 37 years later or so, I get this email that says, where were you in 67? In the subject line. And if the first sentence is, if your answer is Poolboy Vietnam, then you're the Don Holman. Established contact, go out here to visit with me. My wife and I have flown back to visit with him. We maintain a lively correspondence on the email and intend to get together again. So that's the one long-lasting friendship out of it.
Well, that's really cool to hear those kind of stories.
Yeah.
Kind of work out like that. All right, Don. You're with the 11th. You're a clerk. You're working in personnel. Tell me about your job duties there. Tell me what you're going to be doing.
I was pretty much a jack of all trades. I was a fill-in if anybody was on leave or got rotated out or whatever. I just pretty much took over whatever it was that they did. I'm a reasonably quick study. And filled in and filed all the reports. The Army still runs, on paper. Have to get orders to go where they're going to go. They need to get paid. They need to go on R&R. They need to take leave. They need to do whatever it is that they do. And so I did that. And it was okay duty. It was nothing particularly special, nothing particularly dangerous. By that point, we had a security platoon that mostly handled the guard duty, so that was the big deal. We had civilian helpers doing the kitchen work. So fundamentally it was to go from, I think I went there as a private E2, to PFC, to Spec 4, and just sort of do what I did. I was by no means gung-ho, but you know, we'd get up at 6, go to chow, come back, shower, report for a formation where we would be told whatever it was that Army figured was important for us to know. Trundle to the office to do whatever we did, off at noon for lunch, back in the afternoon, off again, 6 or so in the evening, back to chow, hang out, read, listen to music, Beatle music a lot, and hit the rack. And so that would have been a pretty normal kind of day. And it was slack enough so that, you know, if you needed to go wander off and go do something, if you had pretty much everything done that you were supposed to have done, you could walk a quarter mile, half mile with a small PX and you know, buy whatever things that you thought you needed. You could write a letter home. You could tape. I did a lot of tapes to contact my family. And pretty much did that. The only real mistake I made was I never really made friends with the personnel sergeant, who was an E6 bucking for 7. And he was a real pain in the ass. I heard him tell people several times, because I have a mildly wacko sense of humor, that he thought I was a smartass. In fact, one day he called me a smartass, and my response was, and sometimes I say these things, I said, yeah, well, that may be true, but it's better than the alternative. And that did not sit in well with me. So, in the fullness of time, there was a captain who was the safety officer for the battalion, and he came looking for somebody to be his clerk or his assistant or whatever it was. I can't remember the captain's name. I don't remember his name. I remember his face. And I remember he was one of those fundamentalist evangelical Christians. don't do this. I don't want to talk religion. I'll do my job and it'll be fine. But, so I went over to work then as the I worked in the safety office. I don't remember if I had a title at all. But then he rotated out and a major came in, and one of the few officers I met in Vietnam, literally I would have marched into hell. His name was Ronald G. Cluck. Everybody called him Cluck. He had been born in Scotland. He had been a veteran of Korea in the Marines. He had become an army pilot sometime in the 50s. He was a hot stick pilot. God, he was good. And he became the safety officer. And I worked for him for about a month. And he said, "Are you planning on sticking around?" Well, I wasn't planning on it. He said, "Well, if you're thinking of extending your tour, you can take your 30-day leave and go home for 30 days and come back." And he said, "Then I want to talk to you about what happens then." And I thought, well, you know, by the time I'm ready to go home, I will have like 8 or 9 months left in the Army. So I extended my tour, and he said, "When you get back," he said, "you have to understand, I am the senior major in this battalion. I do not have spec fours working. I have sergeants working. You are going to become a sergeant, or if you don't become a sergeant, you're going to become a spec four again. I'm going to give you to the battalion sergeant major. He's going to teach you how to be a sergeant, and you're going to come to work for me, and you're going to be the battalion safety." Oh, really? Yeah. So I went home and did a number of interesting things.
So when did you
remind me to tell you about that, because it's kind of cool and it's a story that's ongoing even now.
Well, when did you decide to extend your tour, and then when did you come home?
Roughly first part of December of 67. And that was mostly because the war for us in 67 had been a piece of cake. At least where I was doing what I was doing, there was no great danger.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'd get mortared every now and then, and it was not a big deal. We got rocketed once. That was when Vic got his Bronze Star.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lot of noise, but not something that was likely to happen very often. And those things are named, so if you get killed with one of those, bad luck, and then because somebody's shooting at you. So, and I had never been away from my family at Christmas ever in my life. And I didn't want to be that here either. I missed the people. By that time, I was missing my family pretty hard. So, I decided to extend for 6 months, which would have gotten me out of Vietnam and out of the Army simultaneously. And that seemed like a good idea. Oh, let me backtrack on one thing.
Please.
Along about March or April of 1967, I got a Twix. That's the equivalent of a fax or an email at the time from the U.S. Army that said, "We see that you have now been conscious, more or less, for the last 6 months without any recurrence or any ongoing problem.
Okay.
You'll be pleased to know that we have a slot for you open at the Warrant Officer Training Program, and so if you would like to do that, just let us know, and you can come back, and you can re-enter that training." Okay, here it is, March of 67. I have been in country long enough to know that being a helicopter pilot is not all that I thought it had been.
Dangerous business.
And so I sent them a nice message back that saying, "Gee, thanks all the same, but I think I'll pass it this one." So, and at that point, I had, 18 months So, and I only had at that point another, 6-7 months to do in Vietnam, so that was a piece of cake. And had I wanted to, I could have gone home and permanently rotated out in January of 68. But I didn't. So, I extended my tour, went home. Sidebar story. The last night before I left to go back to Vietnam the second time, cruising around. night before I went to Vietnam the second time, I bought a car. I bought the car, I drove it home, I put it in my parents' garage, and locked it up, and didn't see it again. Next morning, got on a plane, flew back to Vietnam, and finished up my tour. But I thought about that car every day. Every damn day, I thought, when I get home, I'm going to put the top down, it was a little convertible. I'm going to put the top down, and I'm going to go for a drive. It was the day I didn't think about doing it. And when I got home, that's what I did. Only the drive I took was something like 400 miles, which probably cured me of a whole lot of PTSD problems. Because I remember the tension going away, and thinking, I'm home. Out of the goddamn army. Long story short, I started looking for that car in 2014, figuring it had been crushed or had disappeared or something like that. It was out there somewhere, but I was just curious to know. And be darned! It had, I had sold it to a guy south of Jamestown, North Dakota. Another fellow found it 20-some years ago in a field shot full of oil holes. Dragged it home, fixed it up, and so he contacts me in 2014 saying, I think I have your car. And it turns out he did. So back in August of last year, I went home and bought it. And I now have it here in San Diego. Process of restoring it to the way it was when I first bought it 48 years ago.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, you hardly ever hear about that.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And when I get it done, I will take it to car shows. I'm kind of a car nut. But between that car, which I bought in 68 and sold in 78 when I bought a Datsun 280Z, between that car and the Datsun 280Z, which I still own, I have 50 years of consecutive car ownership. And now I have that original car back. So anyway, I get back to Vietnam in early January of 68. By that time, Vic has gone home. I lose track of him completely. He's just gone. I'm back. In the fullness of time, I am promoted sergeant. And then long about late January of that year, we have the period of great unpleasantness called the Veterans. At which point, the whole picture of the war in my area changed.
Well, let me ask you about that, Don, if I may. You're there, this obviously the first part of your tour before you extend. And granted, you're not on the front lines, you're in the back, but, you know, working where you're working, you are in a position to see a lot of people, to talk to a lot of people, to hear a lot of things that perhaps other people wouldn't be able to. What do you know about the war in 67 as it's going on? What do you understand about what's going on out there?
It was clear to me by late 67 that we were not going to win.
What made that clear to you?
Because we weren't fighting the same war that the other side was.
Do you care to explain that?
Yeah, we were fighting the war that the French did. And the other side was, you know, Mong Nguyen Giap, their general, is fighting this wonderful insurgency war. And we have fundamentally no defense against it. We can line up troops, we can fly airplanes, we can drive tanks, we can do all that stuff. Mong Nguyen Giap has perfect counter strategy. And by that time, you know, I was and still am a serious nuclear warrior. And I had read Sun Tzu and had read a number of other things. Mong Nguyen Giap had this thing: if the enemy advances, retreat. If the enemy retreats, advance. And if the enemy stands, then harass. And just keep banging away. They were doing to us what they did to the French. Since we were not, it was clear to me, for example, I'm going to say this directly, even if it gets me into trouble. William Westmoreland had no idea what war he was fighting. He thought, he really wanted to be Patton, because he had served under Patton in World War II. And so you have these generals, and it's a historical aphorism, that generals are always ready to fight the last one. But that was this one. We had never fought a war like this before, in which our advantage in manpower and firepower and air power and everything. hated by an enemy just simply wouldn't deal with it. And it was obvious to me at some point that we're just going to get tired of it and leave. That was when I became the proponent of, I can't remember if it was something I picked up stateside or something that came to me, but you know, the Tet Offensive. Tet Offensive was, I am convinced, deliberately started by the North, what they called Cosmic Committee on South Vietnam, that did all the war planning. I think it was deliberately started by the North to get rid of the Viet Cong, the local indigenous people that were fighting the war. But I think that the North knew that if they put the Viet Cong on the field, that we'd wipe them out. We just need their corner. Because after the Tet Offensive, there is no more Viet Cong. Everything we see at that point is all North Vietnamese. So it was, but they didn't change tactics. They just got better at it. So it was one of those, we're eventually just going to get sick and tired of this. And it was by that time, by 68, it's becoming clear that the anti-war movement in the U.S. is mostly about that. It's mostly about saying after 5 or 6,000 days of fighting, if we haven't won by now, we're probably not going to. And I recall talking to the battalion interpreter. Bo Van To. He didn't speak very good English, but he spoke better English than most Vietnamese. And certainly I didn't speak Vietnamese well enough to get into it, but he said essentially the same thing. He said, you know, the French left, you will leave too. It doesn't matter what you do. You will just leave. They were right. So by 68, I am. And especially after the Tet Offensive, which was a huge tactical victory. And I recall having a conversation with a friend of mine saying, we should just be clear that we want to go home now. And just let the clock go back to 1954 and let these people fight it out among themselves. And eventually reunify, which they will. And why will they? Because they want to. The South Vietnamese don't like the Vietnamese government. There was a province chief. It was known he was completely corrupt. Absolutely known he was. And the people in the province hated him. And so we were allied with a group of people that the local population hated. And they didn't mind saying so. I thought at the time, but I had no way of proving it, that we had people who knew we weren't going to win it. And it turns out later that Robert S. McNamara says publicly, yeah, I knew all along we weren't going to, but I didn't know how to win. So, yeah, that's kind of how it was. But after the Tet Offensive, there's this period of quiet because the Viet Cong are basically off the field. And the North Vietnamese back. They also get rid of the idiot Westmoreland, who didn't know what war he was fighting, and they put in a guy named Creighton Abrams, the namesake of the Abrams M1A1 tank. And Abrams did know what kind of war he was fighting, but by that time people were tired of him.
You mentioned the South Vietnamese. What was your opinion of them as a fighting force and as a political entity?
I have no opinion of the Vietnamese armed forces, pardon me, the ARVN, the Army of Vietnam. I have no opinion of them as a fighting force because where I was, they weren't. Okay, they just weren't. They were hopelessly in it. As a matter of fact, on any given day, they were so completely infiltrated by either the North or by the VC, that you couldn't be sure that they would just turn on you if they got a chance and go, you know, turn on you, shoot you up, and then go over the other side. I don't know why anybody thought we were training them. I really don't. They had no more faith in their political leadership than the normal peasant folk out there who were just trying to find a way to get them. As far as the South Vietnamese, I should say, the VNAP, the Vietnamese Air Force, competent bunch of hotshot pilots. These were people with 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 combat hours in airplanes, often in those A-1 Sky Raiders, the propeller-driven airplanes. Mm-hmm. And I swear they could put a 250-pound truck bomb in a pickle barrel. They were really, really good. We just didn't see them. The other units, I didn't have any reason personally to think that they were worth a damn. As it turns out, several years later, when the North Vietnamese finally do run their flying assault, they all cut them. Except for down by Hanoi.
Something that you saw firsthand? Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples you could share?
When you see a Arvin Major pull up with a truckload of American supplies and selling them on the streets of Saigon, it gives you an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, they didn't care what they sold. They didn't care what the supplies were. They could sell weapons, they could sell ammunition, they could sell food, they could sell clothing. If they could steal it, and they did, or get it from the shipments of stuff that we were sending them, they would sell it. And we knew full well that the other guys were buying it. Who else would they sell it to? You know, they were the customers, and they had the money, and they did. So yeah.
What about the Vietnamese people themselves? Take the politics, take the military out of it. What about the Vietnamese?
A gentle, well-spoken, to my experience, nice group of people. Now, who did I normally interact with?
Mm-hmm.
The Hooch girls. Some of which were just silly little, and some of which were very nice, like you say, mannerly, respectful, dignified, comes to mind. Even Hooch girls, they were dignified, they were nice people. I remember a couple of them, specifically one was a young lady named Winty Sao. She was the Hooch girl for the guy down the way from me. Convinced her that he was just head over heels in love with her, knocked her up, she had a little baby, he promised to send her money, he rotated home, never talked to her again, she was brokenhearted. I remember his name, I won't use it, I have his picture. His picture is him in a helmet with an M14 and a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. It's only something super cool. Nevertheless, she stayed dignified and she stayed good. You know, and on the other hand, there were some people who weren't. I had a watch that I was very fond of that I kept in my watch and it disappeared 3 days before I left. There were some men, carpenters, enormously skilled, totally hand tools, no power tools at all, and they could build anything, any furniture, any boxes. Quite good. If there was any damage from a rocket attack, they usually have it fixed in 24 hours. They were very proud of what they did. They did good work. They didn't need to be supervised. I basically like most of them. The only time I think we had a problem was one day that a couple of us were walking along and we noticed the guy was fundamentally pacing the interview. He would walk along and obviously he was counting steps and then he would stop and he would take notes. And then he would walk along. But hey, you know, it's a war. Every now and then the bad guys are going to get their licks.
Right.
So, and you have to, or at least I had to admire how those people fought, even the ones I didn't know, the ones who were actively fighting against us. They were damn good. They really were good. They didn't fight the same kind of war we did, but by God, they were good at the war that they fought.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to respect them. Not that they were fighting for their country, not for some abstract ideal. I don't know that among the Vietnamese I ever ran across anybody who was, there are people who thought highly of Ho Chi Minh, but they were by no means communists. They didn't think about that level of abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
So at least that's my sense of it, even now. As a matter of fact, go so far as to say I don't think any of them.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Homuth, I think this is a good time to stop for today.
Okay.
This is Kelly Krieger continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Donald Homuth. Today is 15 April 2016. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech
Hold
University.
Hold on just a second.
Sure.
Hush! Scooters! That's enough. The birds can be at the feeders. Just be cool.
All right.
And Don and Scooter are joining me by telephone from his home in Salem, Oregon.
Yep.
Okay, Don, we left off last time. We had you there in Phu Loi. You kind of explained the day-to-day kind of things that were going on there. And interestingly, you had the offer to extend your tour, which, of course, would have meant that when you came home, you would have been done with your time in the Army for all intents and purposes to work for a safety officer there. But you also mentioned that you had a month-long leave in the U.S. Can you tell me about that month-long leave? You told me a little bit about it, but you get on the bird to come back home. Pick up the story there.
Those were called special leaves, and they were kind of a reward for extending your tour. And if you extended for 6 months, basically the Army said, you can go home for 30 days. We will fly you to your home. You can hang out for 30 days. And come back, and it will not be charged to your leave time, which was, I thought, just a hell of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And since most of 1967, for me anyway, had been, you know, basically a walk in the park, that seemed like just a heck of a good way, you know, finish out my time in the Army. I had enlisted, I was regular Army, but I enlisted for 2 years with the Warrant Officer Program. A lot of people don't know about that. Everybody thought it was. But so I just had to finish out my time until September of 1968, and I was done. And I thought, well, holy smoke, if I go home, I can be with my family at Christmas. I had never been away from them at Christmas before. I can visit with friends and hang out and, you know, laugh and scratch. And so I said, yeah, I can do that. And especially since I had gone to work as the safety NCO, which was an E7 slot on the TONE, and working for a major that I really respected, I thought, yeah, I could do this. So I took the extension, went home, and that was probably the first time I ended up with kind of a few personal, I wouldn't call them traumas, but I had one really bad thing that happened, and I had another one that has turned out, even now, about 38 years later, or 48 years later, to be a good thing.
And this was when you were back home?
This was when I was back home.
And
being back home, it was like, the phrase we used at the time was going back to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the world was Fargo, North Dakota. But, I mean, here were all my friends. And here was the church I had attended, and I'd sung in the choir. And family at Christmas, and extended family. I mean, kind of like everybody showed up. I also got to meet with a, I think it was a fourth grade class at a parochial school in Moorhead, which was just across the river, which was being taught by an old college friend of mine. And the kids had written me letters in Vietnam for several months, and I had personally handwritten the responses to each and every one of them. And they didn't know I was coming, so I got to show up quite by surprise in the classroom.
Oh, that's cool.
And that was about as heartwarming an experience as I can remember. It was really very nice. And in fact, I mentioned it in the book. It has remained a very nice memory for me. The bad thing that happened was, prior to going in the Army and for most of my time in high school and college, I had attended the First Methodist Church in Fargo and had been a member of the choir. It was a very good choir, a really good choir, really, really good. And I loved singing with it. And so in one of the pre-Christmas services, I asked the choir director, who, as it turned out, and this is also in the book, had been the principal of the elementary school that I had attended as a kid. I asked if I could have permission to sing with the choir, and they were doing Handel's Messiah. And I regularly sang either a tenor or a baritone lead in that performance. I knew it fundamentally by heart. And he said yes. So I put on the choir robe and did the march, and it was just, God, it was wonderful. It was like, this is real. Whatever was going on back there in Vietnam was not, but this is. And then a very bad thing happened. Some of the ladies of the choir decided that I really shouldn't have been in there. And they complained to the choir director. And the choir director talked to me about it and said, well, maybe you made a mistake in judgment and you shouldn't have done that. And that burned.
What was their reason for not wanting you to join?
Oh, I don't know. I don't care. Here I was back in Vietnam. Everybody knew I was back in Vietnam. I mean, I had short hair and I wore my uniform regularly, although I don't think I went to church that day. But whatever it was, they just got their knickers all on a twist and were just deeply bothered that this individual had come back from this war and had not attended the rehearsals and all that stuff. And here he was, allowed to sing in the choir just like everybody else. And I had sung in that choir for probably, oh, 6-8 years previous.
And you
and as I mentioned in the book, that was the day that I fundamentally walked away from the church, and not that church, the church generic. I just walked away from it and have not returned.
And you knew these women who were opposed to your being?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I'd known them for years. And I don't know why they did what they did. Sometimes there are people in the world who, I don't know. Freud suggested that one of our main drives is to take our unconscious selves and be conscious of it. I am satisfied that exactly the opposite is true, that people love their unconscious self. It didn't matter to me what their reason was. What mattered to me was what they did. And what they did was basically say that I was not welcome in the choir. I decided, well, if I'm not welcome in the choir, I'm not welcome in the church. And so I walked away from it and have not returned.
Do you suspect that it had something to do with your Vietnam service?
I don't know. You know, it was one of those things, it might have, but it also might not have. It might have just been a social thing or an organizational thing or just a bunch of people who, they were just so protective of that. I mean, back in Vietnam, I was the organist for the battalion chapel, for God's sake. And I roomed with the chaplain's assistant. I got him drunk one night when I got my Dear John letter. it's not that I'm anti-religious. It's just that for them, it didn't seem to matter. Whatever it was that churches teach, it didn't seem to apply to me. I don't know that I have the words to describe properly how deeply that burned. I mean, really deeply. was a major emotional scar. And I will admit, I was in a, I won't call it a fragile state, but I had come home from a war. I was not immune to the effects of the war. I mean, everybody got shot at or bombed or something at some point. And I knew I was going back. And this is in 67, 68. The anti-war movement is beginning to ramp up, but doesn't really hit its full stride.
Mm-hmm.
And nevertheless, it just seemed entirely wrong. And I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah.
Just that did happen. And I went back and I talked to the chaplain about it. I said, "Chaplain, I'm prepared to continue to play the organ for as long as I'm here. Perfectly happy to do that because I think people who need spiritual comfort should get it." And he provided. He was a better chaplain than the earlier one. The earlier one had gone nuts. You got to understand, I'm no longer part of this process. So.
Now, you mentioned the anti-war movement. Had you seen any manifestations of this during your month-long stay there in Fargo?
In Fargo, North Dakota, in the dead of winter? Not damn likely.
What about more generally from the news reports or television or something like that?
You know, I was picking up some of the news reports, but you have to remember, during December of 1967, that was the time when the idiot Westmoreland was back touring the United States and assuring everyone that the war would be over very soon.
Mm-hmm.
That the essentially, it's nearly a verbatim quote, that the VC were no longer capable of mounting a major attack anywhere in the country. I mean, that was the time, and he was saying that.
Mm-hmm.
So, the news media were carrying that and saying, hey, this thing is about over, and it's going to be great. Bung Minh Jap, the Vietnamese general, was a lot smarter. He knew that all he had to do to prove it wrong was to mount a major attack everywhere in the country, which came up in due course, but this was a case of the idiot Westmoreland. The phrase we used at the time in country amongst the troops was stepping on his dick.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that big time. He set up the contingency by making that promise, so that when the promise was not kept, it set a lot of people off.
Yeah. What was the general reaction to you as a veteran coming back from Vietnam, your friends? How did they relate to you? Family members, how did they relate to you?
Family members were okay. I had a brother at the time who was a Marine. He had enlisted some years before I did. He was home for that Christmas. Had not been to Vietnam. He was basically an administrative sort with the 1st Marine Air Wing on Okinawa. My memory is that he spent a lot of time discussing how Army people weren't as good as Marine people.
That sounds about right.
And I spent a lot of time saying, you guys have got a great PR program, but the fact of the matter is, when it comes to what's on the ground, it doesn't much matter. So he was resentful of that. My mom sort of took it all in. My friends, it was kind of like, let's not talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people, ask silly-ass questions, the most common of which was, did you ever kill anybody? And my response to that always was just to look at them and not say anything.
Mm-hmm.
I am not given to telling more stories much.
Yeah.
There is no common frame of reference that would make any sense of that.
Sure.
I can tell you, though, that most of my friends thought that I was perhaps the least likely person to be a military person. I just don't project that very well.
You mentioned that the church issue, the choir issue, was a pretty down moment for you, but you said that you also had a very up moment.
Well, the one with that elementary
with
school, the fourth graders,
yeah.
I wore my uniform to the class. Class was there. My friend Randy Olofsson was the teacher. She knew I was coming. She had the class all there and opened the door and walked in. And you could, you could hear the intake of the inhalation of breath, and the kids almost as one saying, "It's Don." It was so cool. It really was. Just a nice, nice thing to meet all these kids that I'd exchanged personal letters with, and they were very nice little letters. I mean, they really were. And in fact, years later, I met one of the kids in the class when I was at a shopping center. She said, "Aren't you Don Holman?" "Yeah." "I was in that fourth grade class, and I want to tell you that that was one of the nicest things that memories I have of that year." So your heart can get warmed even when you're not really expecting it, and it's always nice when it happens.
Sure. Were you looking, I shouldn't say, were you looking forward to going back to Vietnam? What were your thoughts about having to go back after a month?
Well, at the time, my main memory is that it would have been more of the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, keep in mind, you know, Westmoreland was making all those promises about how it was going to be over, and I thought, cool, it's going to be over. I mean, it, you know, I can go back, and the war will sort of wind down. I will come home. I will get out of the Army. That will be the end of that. I can get on with my life. So it was not that big a deal to me, just as the reason for extending was not that big a deal. But keep in mind, I'm not out pounding the booty.
Sure, sure. Okay, take me back to Vietnam.
Fly back to Vietnam. Land at, let's see, Cam Ranh Bay, take another shot down to Binh Hoa, or Long Binh, Binh Hoa, I think. Hook up with the flight people at Long Binh. We had helicopters flying in and out of there all the time. I think I sat around for like 4 or 5 hours. Caught a helicopter ride back, got off the chopper, walked back, and it was kind of like, "Hi, fellas, I'm back." And not exactly like, "Hello, honey, I'm home." But, "Hi,
right.
fellas, I'm back, and so what's happening?" That would have been, I can't give you the exact day, but that would have been mid-January of 68. And, of course, history records that shortly thereafter, I was also told that I was going to be the NCO of a, what they called the Ready Reaction Force, which was, I used to laugh and call them my combat clerks. As a matter of fact, I designed a badge for them. It was, you know, like the combat infantry badge, except it was going to be a scroll rather than a laurel of typewriter ribbon with crossed pens, which I thought would have been just cool.
Right.
But unfortunately, the Army, the idea never went anywhere.
Yeah.
But it's still a cool idea.
So as the head of the Ready Reaction Force, what would this entail?
Well, the Ready Reaction Force was considered a joke. Mostly it was, if they break through, we have to set up a defensive perimeter in our immediate area and prepare to fight them off. But the idea was that they would never break through because we had bunkers and outposts and all that kind of good stuff out on the line around the perimeter. And, so it would be impossible for them to do that. But, I'm a mildly serious person about such things, and if I told the guys, if you are expected to be able to use these weapons, then you better be able to use them, because you never know when you might have to. And so I did some terrible things. I was then, I think, an acting sergeant, which meant I wore the stripes but didn't get the pay. and so I trundled them off to the range, and we shot the M14. The M60s, the M79 grenade launcher, the M2, the 50 caliber machine gun, at least got them familiarized with the weaponry. I don't know how competent they were, but when you're dealing with automatic weapons, competence is not the big issue. Reliability is. Also walked them around where we would have to set up whatever kind of defensive positions we would have should there be a breakthrough. We were not that far from the wire that had somebody aimed an attack at us, you know, that they might not have gotten through. And being able to blow up a helicopter battalion would be kind of a cool thing if I was a VC, I'd say, yeah, that's a neat idea. And, you know, they complained a lot. You know, why are you making us do this? It's never going to happen. Well, yeah, I know, but it's a good thing. And besides, you know, playing with these expensive toys and converting money into toys is a good idea. So we should probably do some of that. And that was before the Tet Offensive hit us. It starts in country. As I recall, it starts sometime in January, but it doesn't really get to us until about mid-February.
Now take me through this, Don. This is obviously a very important part of your time there and the experience overall of the Tet Offensive. Of course, we know what that was. But from your perspective, what did it mean there at Fulloy? How did it take place? What was going on?
Constant alerts. We were always on alert, it seemed. The condition was seldom green. It was usually yellow or red. It was yellow if somebody thought that maybe perhaps there possibly might be an attack from somewhere. We didn't know where. We were on red alert. One of the, I don't know if you're acquainted with the term H&I fire.
Mm-hmm.
It means harassment and interdiction. And what would happen is somebody would come along with one of those three-wheeled, they call them cyclos. They were like little vans, little tricycle motor scooters. And they would roll up a canvas blind, stick a mortar tube out, fire two mortar rounds, roll the blind down, and motor off down the road. Since at the bunker, nobody could shoot at them unless they got permission. By the time they got permission, they were gone. But those two rounds impacting on the base would immediately put 5,000 or 6,000 men on alert in the bunkers, you know, and just generally, you know, cause an upset until the all clear was declared, which usually took about an hour. But it seemed to me we did that a lot. But since I was working in battalion headquarters, I was closer to the reports of the actions happening elsewhere in the country.
What were you hearing?
I was hearing that the VC primarily and the NVA were on the move. And, you know, we got reports from the north. We monitored Quezon, for example. We knew that was going on. And several of us who, you know, remembered Dien Bien Phu remarked how remarkably similar those situations were at the time. And, you know, mightily cheered the B-52s and all that good stuff. The B-52 strikes seemed to get closer. There was a lot of those. There was an area not far from Fulloy called the Hobo Woods. I think that's the name of it. Where there seemed to be a concentration of both BC and NVA. There were numerous missions attacking that. The helicopters, particularly the gunships, seemed to be flying more missions than usual. And the, generally speaking, when you're on yellow or red alert, then the incidents of putting people on the perimeter line and just generally manning up increased a lot. It wasn't that we didn't know that something was going on. We didn't always know what or from where, but we knew that there was a general sort of thing happening. And in the meantime, what we've been hearing was that Westmoreland had come back with sort of an, oh shit, how did this happen attitude, and was busily trying to figure it all out, which he never did. And meanwhile, things just kept occurring.
Were there any more occurrences of attacks on the base, rocket attacks, mortar attacks, anything like that?
And as a matter of fact, the one that stands out most in memory was the night of the 17th and 18th of February.
Tell me about that night.
Well, the first thing we know about it is a loud boom. And 122 and 140 millimeter rockets make a very loud boom. This wasn't your usual whack that mortar round does. These were loud booms, and they were a big deal. And the sirens went off, and you could hear these hissing sounds, you know, boom, as these rockets came in. And there were a lot of them, a whole lot. It was by far and away the biggest attack that we'd ever had. And, you know, my thing was to make sure that I got my guys into the bunkers outside the hooch. So, you know, I swear, when you hear a boom like that at, oh, dark something in the morning, you jump out of bed, and as you are landing, you have your combat boots on and your helmet and your black jacket. And I think it all happens before you touch ground. But anyway, the into the bunker and count noses, and one of them is missing. And so I had to go find him. He was stoned out of his mind and looking at the pretty explosions. So I ran him back to the bunker, and then some time later, and I'm not sure what it was, a building next to us, I still have a picture of it, in what I think was the 213th helicopter company, the CH-47 unit. Anyway, they had a building that had probably half a dozen bunks in it, but they had, I knew about it, and it was quite against regulations, but you just can't be regulation happy about everything. They had about a ton and a half of ammunition in it.
Hmm.
That was a no-no. You do not store ammunition where people are sleeping. Anyway, a rocket hit it dead on. And it was maybe less than 100 feet from where the bunker was. And I stuck my head out of the bunker and looked, and here this building is partially demolished and on fire, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, shit, it's got 3,500 pounds of ammunition in there. And this would have been small arms right up to the M79 grenade launcher. So if that stuff goes off, it's going to leave a big hole. And it's probably going to take out the bunker. I mean, a big hole. 3,500 pounds is a big bang if it all detonates at once. So, and this is, the memories of this are fuzzy, because it was a very long night, a very long day, and a very long next night. But I had a kid. God, this memory almost tears me up. He was what in some units would have been called a crud.
Mm-hmm.
He had green teeth and he smelled, okay? And the only job he could do, I don't know how he got in the military, had to be drafted, but the only job he could do was drive a water truck and fill up the shower tanks and whatever. That was it. That was the limit of his capacity. I don't think the guy could have thought his way out of the sack. But anyway, he was the driver of the water truck, and I was the NCO of then the Radio Action Force, and also, not coincidentally, as an additional to the damage control team.
Hmm. Okay.
And I had a 51 M40 MOS, which is a firefighter crash rescue. It occurs to me that the fire has to go out. So, I nabbed the kid. I wish I could remember his name. God, so much of that's missing. I grabbed him and said, let's go. So the two of us took off, wandered about probably 50 yards across the compound, got the water truck, and while this is going on, by the way, the mortars and the rockets are still coming. Drive to the water point, we fill the water truck up full of water, we drive back to where this building is on fire, and I slap a firefighting nozzle on the hose, and he starts the pump, and I go into the building.
Wow.
Well, no, the Army got themselves all excited about that. They thought that was particularly cool. I remember thinking at the time, shit, if this place torches off, they won't even find enough of me to bury. I'll just be a DNA smear across the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, if it does torch off, it's going to kill a lot of people. And so I went to the building and fought the fire. There were a couple of small bangs when some small arms went off, but it was no big deal. And I could find the source of where the fire was burning and put the hose on it, then put the fire out. And came back out. Crap is still falling out of the sky. Air pollution came in very large, fast-moving chunks at that point. There was a rocket went off probably
I don't know, 30, 40 meters away that sprayed me with some gravel, but it was no big deal. I mean, it was, you know, it's laterite. It's mostly sand. It's not really even gravel as people understand the term. And I didn't think much of it. And so back to the bunker and counted noses, and everybody's there. And eventually the attack stops. And then we have to go. We have to go back out. And there's always a lot of unexploded ordnance, and that has to be marked. So I've got half a dozen guys with these little flags on wires, these little red flags. And so we're wandering around the area, and we're putting little red flags near. I think the rule was it had to be within, oh, I don't know, 2 meters or something like that of unexploded mortars. There weren't any rockets that I can recall, but mortar rounds were pretty. They didn't go off. Sometimes they did, which was a, you know, what was the phrase at the time? It was, it would ruin your whole day. But we did that and did all we were supposed to do, and by that time it was early in the morning and we were back on duty, but at this point there was going to be an attack. We knew it was coming, and I think there were two NVA units. In my mind, I remember two numbers, the 241st and 242nd. I don't know if they were battalions or regiments or what. But anyway, then they attacked the perimeter, and so the Ready Reaction Force is set up in defense, and we're up all night. And at that point, we are doing something we probably should not have done. The survival kits that were on aircraft had a container of Benzedrine tablets, and I never saw one on an aircraft that ever had that Benzedrine tablet container intact in it, but magically they appeared, and so we were pretty much wired on Benzedrine for the rest of that day and into the evening. And then finally it all sort of goes away, and I don't know, I went to sleep for, I think, 17 hours, if I remember right.
Hmm.
Yeah, but anyway, that action with the burning building, that's what earns me the Bronze Star for Valor.
Wow. That's incredible, Don. How long were you in the building putting out the fire, do you recall?
God, I don't know. I suspect it was probably at least 10 or 15 minutes.
Really? Wow.
It might have been less. It might have been more.
Sure.
Time does a funny thing when you're doing that. It's kind of like it suspends, and you just sort of do what you do. And at least to me, as I say, I'm trying to remember that now 48 years later. But it was... You ever seen movies where they do this sort of time suspension thing,
mm-hmm.
and things move really slow? And everything was in slow motion. So it could have been 2 minutes for all I know. But it... It feels now like it was maybe 10 minutes, maybe 15, I don't know.
Yeah.
The thing that you're taught in firefighting school is that you don't just tamp the fire down. You, especially when ammunition is involved, you do all of it. You get every last bit of it, and then you soak it again. And then you try to remove ammunition from the area so that, you know, and separate it so it isn't all big pile. My memory is that I didn't do that part of it. I think that was done maybe by some engineering types who showed up later. But the memory is hazy. I wish I remembered it clearly, but I really don't.
Mm-hmm.
That it happened, I mean, I wouldn't have got that medal if some people hadn't seen it.
Right.
Now, the sad part of the story, part that breaks my heart, is I wrote the kid up, the crud.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote him up for a Bronze Star. You can't write yourself up, but I thought he was incredibly brave, and he was. And in some ways, he was kind of like a puppy dog. If I told him to go, he would go. You know, yeah, Sarge, whatever you say. Bang. And he was there, and he was running the truck. And I will tell you, he was not well-liked in the unit, but he was there. And when it counted, he was there to do it. And I wrote him out. And I don't know if he ever got the medal.
Hmm.
What I do know, because one of the few things I got from Vietnam after I came home, was that 6 weeks after I left, he put a shotgun in his mouth and took the back of the
center. Oh, my.
And it haunts me to this day that I may have been the only friend he had, but I don't know. It's just one of those, damn. And I wish I did, and I wish I knew his family, and I wish I could say something good, but I don't know who he was. I really have no idea. I don't know if he ever got the medal. I suspect he probably didn't. And that's sad, too. But, yeah.
That's an incredible story, incredible chain of events there.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, it's unusual. And even now, I almost want to cry about it, because it's just so incredibly sad. But the people that talk big, you know, I'm going to be an airborne ranger, I'm going to live a life of danger, I'm going to go to Vietnam, I'm going to kill all the Vietnam, all that stuff that they had us sing while we were marching, that's a lot of crap. The big talkers are not the ones, in my experience, that are the ones who are there when the pressure's on. And I remain psychologically, eternally grateful to this kid. I don't know that anybody else would have done it. But he, you know, it was like, yes, Sarge, okay. And he did.
Hmm. You mentioned that the ready reaction force, such as it was on the defensive next day into the next evening.
Yeah.
Did you guys see any enemy action? Were you firing weapons at the enemy coming in?
No, they never really got close to us.
Yeah.
You know, that we were very much internal. The Ready Reaction Force would have opened up only if and only if they had broken through. Now, did they try to break through? Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did. But did they get through? No.
Never got that far.
No. So, but that doesn't change anything. Every time you hear a shot, you know, it's the nature of shooting that if you hear a shot, it's 10 feet away. It's not clear across the compound.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we knew we were, to all intents and purposes, we were surrounded. There was a lot of bad guys out there. And they brought in all kinds of pressure. I mean, they brought in the helicopter gunships. They brought in the fast movers. If memory serves, they brought in Puff the Magic Dragon. They brought in an AC-47 who goes to the area. We were a big helicopter unit, and it would have been a very bad thing had they gotten on base.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out they didn't.
I want to go back to something you mentioned a moment ago during this attack. You said you went after someone who had, you said was high.
Yeah.
Stoned. Can you talk to me a little bit about the prevalence of drugs and drug use as you saw it in Phu Loi?
There was no prevalence in the strict sense of the term. There was some occasional use. There were some stoners there. My rule to my guys was, when the condition is green, I don't care what you do. You want to go get drunk? Go get drunk and throw up in your shoes for all I care. When the condition is yellow, you will stop. You just will, because we're interdependent, and you know, we don't know which way things are going to go. So if the yellow alert lasts all night, then you won't drink that night. If it's red, not only no, but hell no. Okay? Well, the alert that night went to yellow, and then to red, but there was several hours anyway. So there was this kid. I have a vague memory of his name, but I think it's wrong, so I won't use it. But anyway, there was this kid who kept on toking up. Now, I didn't have a whole lot of drug use. Alcohol was the drug of choice. But this kid had apparently picked up some marijuana someplace, and he kept smoking all through the yellow alert and into the red. And I had told guys, if you, you know, I'm telling you this, and I'm very serious, if you don't do as I instruct, which was basically the policy of the unit, if you don't do as I instruct, I will court-martial your ass and send you to some POL, petroleum oil lubricant depot, out in the middle of nowhere. But I will court-martial your ass. I just won't put up with it. You will not put the rest of these people in danger. And he did. I had to go find him. He was just around the corner of the Hooches. He wasn't all that far away, but he was watching the explosions on the airfield. And my memory is that I basically kicked him back to the bunker. And then after the whole thing was over, then I went into the captain and said, sir, well, don't you think that an Article 15 would be more appropriate? I said, no, sir. I told these guys that if they did that, I would take it so seriously that I would court-martial. And your job is to back me up. And he sort of looked at me and said, okay, I'll back you up.
Hmm.
So he backed me up, and the MPs came, and they took him, and there was a court-martial. And I can't remember. I think it was like 30 days in Long Beach jail. Might have been more. And an immediate transfer to some other unit elsewhere. But, and the other guys said, you know, weren't you a little hard? Nope. He was putting your butt in danger. If I need a guy, and I don't have a guy because he's whacked out of his mind, that means I got to find somebody else to take his place, and I wouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the one and only time I ever worked a court martial. But it was for good cause, and I think it had the desired effect because I never had another incident.
Yeah. What was the morale like in your unit overall?
Sort of depended who you talked to.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the tour, February of 67, pretty high. But what wasn't there to be, you know, bummed about? We were there. We were doing what young men do. We had easy access to cheap beer. The duty wasn't that hard. Nobody was a real pain in the ass. If any of the senior NCOs were a pain in the ass, funny things happened to them.
Such as what?
Well, there was one, for example, there was an E6 bucking for E7. And when he got sent home, the rumor was that his 201 file went into a burn barrel. Now, you don't know what a 201 file is, but...
I do, but can you explain it to those who might not understand?
That's everything. From the day that you enlist, that's everything that the Army knows about you. All your pay records, all your promotion records. It was at the time, since it wasn't electronic, it was the only copy of who you really are. And as a rule, when somebody got transferred out, their records were sent up. Sometimes they hand-carried them themselves. Sometimes they were taken elsewhere for them. And somewhere between the 11th Battalion personnel and the 12th Group personnel, that one got lost. My recollection is it ended up in the bottom of a desk drawer someplace. It's another pile of papers. And then about 3 weeks later, after the guy was safely gone, probably back home, it was burned. Which meant that the Army had to spend months putting it back together, which meant that at the time the guy could get promoted, how it is. There was another one, was he an E7 or an E8, and he was bucking for the E7 bucking for E8. He was the acting first sergeant of the unit. He had a thing for 12-year-old girls. And he would take a couple to the newsrooms and lock the door. And one night he was visited by a purple smoke grenade with a note that said, the next one can be a frag, although he didn't kill him. But for some strange reason, the morning report, which is the document basically that informs fire headquarters, One copy of the morning report at the battalion was that he was in the slot and was where he should be. And the other copy that went up to higher headquarters was that he was a fully qualified senior infantry NCO and was excess. And excess infantry NCOs tended to be transferred almost immediately to infantry units, and so in 48 hours he was gone. At least at the time, it was best not to screw with the spec folks. Because, I mean, if somebody was just a little martinet, and this guy surely was, unpleasant things happened. Records would be lost, transfers would happen, R&R requisitions would get sidetracked. For some of the people, they knew full well who the enemy was, and it wasn't the VZ, it was the lifers. But even that was done with morale. It was kind of like, you're never going to guess what we did to that guy. So, those things happen.
You mentioned R&R. Tell me about your R&R.
Well, I had three of them.
You had three of them?
Yeah.
Not bad.
In something like 20 months in country, you could get one R&R for a year, but if you extended, you were authorized a second R&R. And then if there was an excess R&R, somebody didn't show up or whatever else was involved, on a sort of catch-as-can basis, every now and then you could snarf one of those up. I had had, when I was at North Dakota State University, a really good relationship with then Major, later Lieutenant Colonel, Robert A. Hansen, in the Air Force ROTC. He was an Air Force intelligence officer, and he was transferred to Bangkok. And so I managed to find a way to get hold of him. I don't remember exactly how. But anyway, he said, yeah, y'all come over and spend a week with us. We'd love to have you, because we were good friends on a personal level. So I wangled the R&R, told him what was going on, and got the flight to Bangkok, and got off, went to the R&R station, and ran into the damnedest thing. It was fairly clear that the R&R personnel had some sort of arrangement with local hotels. I think calling it bribery or kickback would not be too far off the line, as events turned out. And so I get off, I'm going through the processing, and one of the NCOs said something like, okay, tell us what hotel you're staying at. And I said, I'm not. I'm not staying at an R&R hotel, I'm staying at the Imperial Hotel, which in Bangkok was not a place where R&R people normally went. It was the place where the Japan Airlines, personnel stayed over. Fine old hotel. The only reason I stayed there and not with the Colonel was that the Colonel was entertaining other friends from elsewhere. So I said, I have reservations at the Imperial. And the guy says, that's not an R&R hotel. I said, I don't care. That's where I have reservations. And you'll love this. You can't take girls to that hotel. And I said, good. And he looked at me like I was some sort of alien creature. And he said, well, I can't authorize transportation there. And I said, pardon me. And I pulled up these papers. And I said, I'd like you to talk to this gentleman. So he calls up, and he said, what's this guy's name? I said, his name's Bob Hansen. I didn't give him his rank. And so this, I remember it was a lieutenant who called. This young lieutenant calls, and he answered again. I only hear the one side of the conversation, but it goes something like this. Is this Bob Hansen? Oh, pardon me, sir. Colonel Bob Hansen. Yes, this is Lieutenant. I have a young Spec 4 here, and he says he has reservations at the Imperial Hotel. Is that correct, sir? And after that follows a series of about a dozen yes or yes or yes or yes or yes sir. Absolutely, sir, right away, sir. What Bob had told this young lieutenant was that he would be down shortly to pick me up. And he would personally take me to the Imperial. And that the lieutenant should do everything in his power to ensure that my transportation arrangements were made in a suitably rapid military fashion. I think Bob was there in 19 minutes. And he was driving a Buick Skylark convertible. So I'm standing at the curb with my luggage. Nobody is believing this. But anyway, so we had, Bob took me to the hotel and all was well. And 2 days later, Bob said, oh, by the way, there's something you should know. I initiated an investigation into the R&R personnel, and they're all being transferred out.
Wow.
He said, yep, we will not put up with that. He said that it's not up to them to decide what sort of hotel you should go to. And it turns out that there's probably some sort of kickback thing going on. You don't need to know anything more about it. But that was a great R&R. I did things that, for most of the personnel who went to Bangkok, it was not R&R, it was I&I, intoxication and intercourse. They got drunk, they stayed drunk, and they basically screwed their eyes out for a week. I got to do all kinds of interesting cultural things. I went to the Bangkok National Museum. I went to a couple of just extremely good restaurants. Went to the nightclubbing with the colonel and his wife and another young lady that they brought along from someplace. And just had just a really very pleasant 5 days. Didn't get drunk and didn't get laid. But it was most enjoyable. The second R&R to Bangkok was different. I stayed with the colonel, and that was, fundamentally, that was the colonel's wife's shopping trip. She was not one of those people who could bargain with local folks. I, on the other hand, can and do and did and love doing it. And so took her on a big-time shopping trip. The third R&R was to go to Hong Kong. That was in August of 68, shortly before I came home. I went there with $6,000 in my pocket. I had the best shopping spree in my life. I went to all the places where you could buy all the neat stuff, the cameras and the hi-fis. I had handmade shoes made to individually fit my feet. I had suits made. I had all that stuff. And the beauty of it was you could buy all this stuff. And if you gave them a copy of your orders, they would send it home at military expense. So each day, it was like 4 or 5 crates of stuff went home. I had and some that I still have. I bought the then extant complete collection of all the Beatle records on a Parlophone, which was not the Apple or the Capitol records that they had here. I think I have a few other things left with that. But to go to Hong Kong in 1968, spend $6,000 and not buy a drink and not buy a whore, that's not bad.
Yeah, that's not bad at all.
And it was fun when I got home because I didn't tell my mom it was coming, but one day a truck pulled up and unloaded these 5 big crates, and it's basically a treasure trove, and I've got all kinds of crap in it I bought for my family. I mean, my mom was good at sewing, so I bought her, like, bolts of silk cloth and treasures for them. I had a brand new hi-fi, stereo hi-fi, best components I could lay my hands on, which I eventually put into my apartment in college, and nobody else had a stereo anywhere close. But, that was go to Hong Kong, go back. By that time, I'm so short that I couldn't even be seen. And I've got my replacement trained, Spec 5. And I was then in a situation where if anybody spoke to me, I would either respond by saying short or Figmo. Do you know about Figmo?
Yes, but please explain.
Figmo would be the acronym for Fuck It, Got My Order, which meant that I had my orders in hand, and not only was I going home, but I was getting out of the Army. So at that point, there's nothing they could do to me. I only had one more little set to, because after I got my replacement train, for a week or 10 days, the first sergeant was sort of on my case. He gave me some of McNamara's wonders. I don't know if you remember those. Wise. Those were the people who were drafted immediately before the length of hall to 6th in line. And these were people who, if they were told to fill a sandbag, a hole for a better bunker, you know, below the ground bunker, and the first sergeant gave me like 2 dozen these people and picks and shovels, and there's this hard laterite soil. He said, you're in charge of digging this hole, so big, so big, so big, and I thought that was pretty stupid, so I called up the engineers. They had a big payload, and but I had asked the first sergeant, why don't we just get the engineers to dig these holes? Well, they don't have the equipment or the personnel. Get these guys to fix the shuttles, and the first sergeant takes off and goes down to Saigon to visit his force. And I called up the engineers and said, this is Homeland over at 11. Can I talk to him? I can't remember who it was, but I said, I got 6 bottles of scotch. Can you bring your payloader over? Sure. So he comes over and he digs the hole, and we're done by 10 o'clock, 10:30. So I gave the guys the rest of the day off, and sat down in my chair to catch some rays. And the first sergeant comes back 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, something, and sees this big hole. And how did you get this done so fast? They said, well, I called the engineers. Well, they told me that they didn't have any people. I said, Pop, I've been in this country a long time, and it's not what you know, it's who you know. Yeah, he was pissed, but it was worth it. As I got shorter, I just didn't care anymore. I was going home, and that was the end.
Yeah. Well, I have just a couple more questions before we put you on the Freedom Bird here, Don. Tell me about your time working for the safety officer. This was basically 6 months, the extension part of your tour was working for this major. Can you tell me about your duties there, what would be involved?
Well, aviation units have a very active safety program because, I mean, losing a helicopter in combat is one thing, and we had a way of dealing with that. But losing it to an accident is basically working for the enemy. So, you know, every incident, every blade strike, every bullet hole, everything had to be either an incident report or an accident report. An accident was when the ships were no longer flying, and a helicopter has a glide angle of approximately a rock. So we lost a lot of people, sometimes to shoot downs, sometimes to mechanical failures, or sometimes to just plain screw-ups. There's one hilarious story about a screw-up that we're talking about. There had to be an investigation team. There had to be a formal report filed. There had to be recommendations made for how not to have this problem again. If there were mechanical failures in a component, that was recorded and the component shipped back to Fort Rucker. And it was a fairly exhaustive process. And when I was doing the administrative work for the major, essentially I handled that. So we'd get a report of a helicopter going down. I would get down to operations, and we'd lay on perimeter security. We'd get a ship to fly out there to take a look. We'd get a team. Had to be at least one regular officer. It could be a couple of warrant officers, depending. We'd fly out. We'd take exhaustive photos. I did much of that on the ground, sometimes in Indian territory, and we'd look at what happened. A lot of times, the bodies were taken out at that time. Helicopters, when they crash and burn, fundamentally burned to a fine white dust, and so the bodies left are pretty bad. And fundamentally, they're black. So then compiling those reports and getting them back to Fort Rucker in a reasonable amount of time, and sometimes there were multiples. If we had, you know, big operations, there would be 3, 4, 5 reports at a time, and I handled that. Was my administrative duty.
All right, another question that I wanted to ask you, and this is something that comes up from time to time, and it depends on the person's perspective, and it depends on where you served in Vietnam, and this is the old eternal rear echelon versus the grunt. What kind of relationship did you have with the guys who were out in the field every day?
None.
None whatsoever.
just didn't interact.
Yeah.
Very few people in aviation units interacted on a regular basis with anybody on the ground. Now, that doesn't mean we didn't run across them from time to time, but it wasn't enough to have a relationship. But on the other hand, on those rare occasions when I did get to talk with any of them at length, they weren't resentful. They were somewhat envious, but they weren't resentful. We were the guys who, you know, kept them, we got them paid, we got their R&Rs, we got them shipped in and out at the appropriate time, we handled their medals and awards and promotions and all that sort of good stuff. And for me, though, my main administrative duty at that time was to handle the whole safety question. And in addition to doing that, I was also, because the major was responsible for aviation safety, I was responsible for ground safety.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did the aviation side, and I did the ground side. And ground side was important. There was one example in one of our areas. There was a huge, what had been a well. It was probably 40 feet deep, and it was open. It was probably, I'm guessing, 4 feet in, across. And it was just a big open hole. There was no fence around it. It had not been filled in, da-da-da-da-da. And I watched one night as some kid came staggering out of the M Club and went within about 4 feet of it. I thought, shit, if he falls down, he's going to die. So I wrote a directive to the first sergeant of that company, and he came back and said, "You don't have authority to do that." I said, "Try me." I said, I'm on good terms with the battalion commander, and he will tell you to fill it in. So just fill it in, and don't make a lot of weight. Just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was junior to him, but battalion staff can do things that line companies sometimes can't.
Sure.
I don't think he was resentful. But I remember a couple of the other guys saying, "Geez, I'm glad you filled that in. We were always kind of scared of that a little." That was never a big problem for me. There were some ground pounders in the unit, the security platoon. But as ground pounders go, they had it pretty well made. They were infantry MOS types, and they did a lot of perimeter guard. But they slept in cots with sheets and had decent chow, and so they thought they were. Can I tell you one funny story?
I hope you do.
One of the incidents down in the Mekong Delta was there's this thing when a pilot is really tired, that it's called fixation. And down the Delta is kind of like your area of West Texas. It's basically flat, except it has these little mounds on them, and they have these banyan trees. Banyan trees are interesting because the Buddha was enlightened underneath the banyan tree. They're huge, great big things. 60, 70, 80 feet tall. Anyway, down there on a mission, a young lieutenant took off with his helicopter and fundamentally flew into a banyan tree. Just flew into it.
Hmm.
He wasn't very high or going very fast, but it wrecked the ship and put it on the ground, and there was an investigation. And we discovered that the guy had flown something like 11 or 12 hours that day, which was way beyond operational parameters,
right.
But it was necessary to do it. So there was a number of things, you know, recommendations, lessons learned. You know, don't let him fly that often, you know, or, you know, make sure that the commanding officer da-da-da-da tells about him. And I had thrown in as a joke, and I told the major, I said, why don't we tell him to cut down the tree? So this gets sent in to Fort Rucker. And in about 3 weeks, we get a Twix back that says, yeah, go ahead and implement all those recommendations, including cutting down the tree. So the major looked at this and handed it to me with a funny look in his face and said, okay, Sergeant, you're in charge. And I said, what should I do? He said, what you have to do, he said, now listen to me very carefully. You must report to them that the tree has been cut down. Okay, we can do that. So I got down to operations, and I said, I need a ship. And I got hold of the Pathfinders, and I said, I need six of your guys with a couple of those big chainsaws that you use to cut the wings off aircraft so they can be lifted out. I got hold of the cooks and I had them lay in basically a picnic lunch, some chow to carry along, and I managed to carry along a cooler of beer that was unauthorized. Anyway, we flew down to the Mekong Delta. We had no idea where the damn tree was, but we landed out in an area that looked like it was going to be just fine. And sat down, and all the personnel, the two officers, and all the personnel had a nice picnic lunch. And we talked about the day, and got back on the ship and flew home. And Major said, "And?" I said, "Sir, I'm about to report to Fort Rucker that the tree has been cut down." Good. So that report went in. But I can now say 48 years later that that tree is probably still standing.
And Fort Rucker, none the wiser.
Well, you know, that was one of the things I liked about working for the Major. He was a Mustang. He'd been an enlisted man, and had been around a while, and kind of knew how things were done. So when he said, "It's important that you report that the tree has been cut down," he did not say, "Cut down the tree."
Right.
Person has to learn how to follow orders very specifically.
Another question I wanted to ask you about your time here in the rear was at Fuloy. It was about the issue of race. It's a controversial topic when it comes to the Vietnam War, and there are a lot of them. But what about the issue of race in the unit, as you saw?
In my unit, minimal, right up until Martin Luther King got killed. And then things got a little tense, and everybody was a little nervous, and the black guys were self-separated. They, rather than just sort of be around, you know, they would sit in a group in the corner of the EM club. I didn't, by that time I was mostly going to the NCO club. Things got a little bit tense. On the other hand, one of my best buddies was an E5 supply type. It's always good to know the supply type.
Sure.
And so he and I used to pal around. He was black. And some of his black friends asked why he was doing palling around with me. And he said, "Because that's my friend. And, you know, something like, I know he would have my back, and I'm not going to give him up now." So, personally, did I experience much of that? No. Was I aware that it was there? Yes. Did anything ever happen where I was? Not that I recall. We did hear reports that some things happened elsewhere. I can't confirm or deny them. I just have no information.
Yeah. Okay, Don. You're short.
Oh, I was short.
Tell me about the process of, or being short and the process of working your way to the Freedom Bird and coming home.
2 days before I left, I had a party. It was a pretty good party. We had some steaks, we had some hamburgers, we had a lot of beer, and I basically threw a party for the guys. Just said, "Y'all come." As a matter of fact, it was such a good party that the officers who normally hung out over by this little swimming pool that they had came over to my party, which was just as well because most of the food and the booze was stolen from the officers' club anyway. But I had a good party, and, you know, the usual round of, "Gee, it's been nice, and it's been good serving with you, and a lot of, we're going to have to stay in touch." And all of us knew we wouldn't. That was not going to happen. And it didn't. I mean, when I left, I got on that, I didn't get drunk at my party. I got up. I cleared post. That reminds me of something else. A month before I left, I was appointed to the additional duty of Assistant Battalion Reenlistment NCO, mostly so somebody could sign off on their clearing post orders. And and they all came in, and there was nobody who wanted to talk about reenlistment except for this one kid. And I said, are you thinking about reenlistment? "Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I am." I said, "You're nuts. Come back in an hour." But cleared post, got through all the good stuff, and I think my final act before I got on the ship, on the helicopter, was to go into the Major and to draw up and whip him a smart and right proper military salute. stand out as the best officer I have ever been around, served under, known, and should you ever, you know, gratuitous crap. You know, something to the effect of, should you ever need me, give me a call. Well, he never did. And, but I meant it. I really, truly respected the man for who he was, for his character, for all that stuff, and it was one of those things where it was a genuine honor to be able to salute him with all the respect that that act deserves. And I walked out to the airfield. I think I had a couple of friends with me. We sort of shook my hand as we took off, and I went off, went to Long Bin, took a, I think a C-130 to Cameron Bay, and a day and a half later flew out of Cameron.
What was the flight like leaving?
The pilot, as soon as we lifted off, there was a small cheer, and then the pilot said, "We are now crossing the coast." It was in minutes. We are now crossing the coast of Vietnam, and you're on your way home. At which point, everybody went slightly nuts. A lot of cheering. The steward and I were serving beer, not hard drinks. And we went to Anchorage, Alaska, and sat down, refueled, did all that stuff, and flew to shore, Fort Lewis, Washington. The only picture I have of me in my Class A uniform at the time was taken during that trip. But I have it. But it was just a snapshot taken by a friend of mine, or by a guy I knew on the plane. I said, you know, I really should have something to show that I did this, so I'm on my way home, and I have my travel orders tucked into the cap I was wearing. You can kind of just barely see.
So you come into Fort Lewis. Is that where you separate from the Army?
Yep. And it was great. And, you know, did the usual groups of things, and the medical checkups, and, you know, the final pay issue, and the authorization travel and whatever it was, but I decided you can have all that military standby travel you want. And by the way, the military standby travel, that meant that you got to wait around at the airport for a day or two while you waited for a flight. But you could get it on the military's dollar. I had, during my time in Vietnam as an NCO hanging around the NCO club, I had played a lot of poker and faded bets on the dice tables. And so when I came back, I had a lot of money. I had probably somewhere between $16,000 and $18,000 in a wonderful bank account that I kept the checkbook for years. It was the Chase Manhattan Bank Saigon branch. But I had called ahead and reserved a first-class ticket out of SeaTac. And so when they let me go at 00001, whatever that day was, I was out of the orderly room. I was first to get out. I had a cab waiting for me. I hand the guy a $20 bill and I said, get me to SeaTac now, RFN, now. And bless his heart, he got me there. And I walk into SeaTac, and there's this long line of people standing around, waiting for military standby processing and all that stuff. And as I walk in with, I've got one bag, and I'm checking another one. And somebody in the line says, line's over here, Sarge. I said, thanks all the same, fellas. I got a first-class ticket. I'm going home. And so I wander over to the, it was Northwest Airlines, I think. And they were flying direct. They were somewhat surprised to see an E-5 sergeant with a first-class ticket. I didn't care. And so I got on the thing and got into a first-class seat and fell asleep. I got to Minneapolis, got off. I think I had probably the last barbershop shave that would have been given, because nobody does barbershop shave anymore. And I had a shoe shine. Breakfast, and got on another Northwest plane, and flew to Fargo, where my family was waiting for me.
Tell me about that reunion.
Well, that was neat. Whole family was there, and this was at a time when we didn't have jetways. But it was August. You know, I got off the airplane, and everybody was there, including my little one of my sisters, who was carrying her bunny rabbit. And it was, Mom had, of course, had tears in her eyes. My stepfather was standing by, sort of nonplussed with the whole thing. You see, he was a World War II vet, also in an Army aviation unit.
Hmm.
So, you know, it was kind of like, you know, okay, you're home. So it was nice, hugs all around, got in the car, drove home. I spent the next two, 3 hours pretty much lying to my parents.
About what?
Danger.
Mm-hmm.
I was never in any. That's what I told them, which was manifestly not true. But, you know, I wasn't in as much danger as other people were, so I just downplayed it.
Yeah.
Everything was fine. That was when my mom told me something that I think is kind of neat. She said, "I'm very proud of you for winning that medal, but I want you to know that if you had died, I would have gone right up until the ceremony, and then I would have refused it. And I would have told them that I don't want the medal, I want my son back."
Hmm.
And that brought tears to my eyes. But, you know, it was just, you know, I think I got home something like 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. And by noon, I pretty much talked everything out. And then it was time to go for a ride in my car.
You mentioned that you went for you bought a new car on your special leave home. What kind of car did you buy?
I bought a 1966 Corvair Corsa. That's the sport model convertible.
Very nice.
Black interior, white top, 4-speed, all the dashboard, you know, tachometer and all that good stuff. I always thought it was a very pretty little car, and so I bought that. Literally bought it, drove it home, put it in my parents' garage, and flew back to Vietnam.
You mentioned that you took quite a little drive. Was this to help?
300 miles.
Was this just to kind of air things out a little bit, give yourself some alone time now that you're back in the world and Vietnam and the Army is behind you?
For every day I had been in Vietnam in 1968, I thought, and I remember vividly, I thought to myself, when I get home, I'm going to put the top down on my convertible, and I'm going to go for a drive. So I went to the Minnesota Lake District, which is sort of like old home stomping grounds to me. I drove by the old Boy Scout camp I used to go to. I just drove everywhere. It was a lovely, nice day. The top was down. Car was running well. I was no longer in Vietnam. And I think it was enormously therapeutic. Hard to say, but it was a big deal. It was a very nice experience. And I think I got home that evening somewhere between 8 and 9 o'clock, and my mom said, "You've been gone a long time." "Yes. Where did you go?" "I don't know." "I just went." But then I went to bed, and probably around 9:30. And that wouldn't have been too bad, except some asshole drove down the street and threw a cherry bomb out the window just about the middle of the block that I lived on. And there's this loud boom, and my memory kicks in with my stepfather standing beside me, you know, on the bed, and I'm trying to get underneath it.
And that was the very first night back.
That was the very first night back.
Yeah, that's.
I would still like to find that individual and slap him upside the head a couple of times. "You asshole! You have no idea what you did." But it's okay.
Yeah.
I got over it.
What did you hope to do once you got back? What was the future going to be for you?
I had no idea. I was going to go back to school.
You did want to go back to school, okay.
I was going to go back to school. As a matter of fact, I got out of Vietnam probably 2.5-3 weeks early because I had, you know, signed up for going back to college.
Mm-hmm.
I normally wouldn't have gotten out until probably the end of September. I got out at the end of August. I would have gotten out sometime about 15th or 16th of September. And I got out on, I think, the 28th of August. So I had a 2.5-week drop, an early out for going to college. I had applied for it, and the Army apparently was of the opinion that start having Sergeant Holman there for another 2 weeks was not going to win the war, and so they let me go.
So you go back to school, and you go back to North Dakota State, correct?
Yep. Yep.
What was it like to be back in the world and going to school? Explain that.
I don't want this to sound too egotistical, but I'm really bright. I know what my IQ score is, and it's quite good. I have good study habits. I'm a damn fine student, and I almost flunked out. Really.
Why?
I don't know. I was one of those... I thought that it would be cool, and it wasn't. You know, I mean, I'm back. It was just hard kicking back into it. It took me a full quarter. I almost flunked out that quarter. I was just really in some deep trouble. I had signed up for some history courses, things like, you know, Asian history and da-da-da-da-da, to try to understand better what it was I had just been through. I just could not put it back together again. It was like my attention span was measured in microseconds. It was pretty grim. It was an awful time. I think I went on academic probation that first quarter back, which would have been a first for me. I had never done that before. So it took a quarter of I don't know, reintroduction to the world. I got involved in some other things. I got involved with the student newspaper. I did a bunch of other stuff. The student newspaper was then being run by another veteran, although he had not been to Vietnam. And by that time, the anti-war movement is kicking in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was aware of, but not involved with, the anti-war kids on the campus. But then again, this is North Dakota, so it was never going to be anything like Berkeley.
Right.
And it was never going to be all that big a deal. And in fact, I thought that the anti-war students mostly pretty funny. they were not what you'd call exceptionally well organized. I mean, even as a returning sergeant, you know, I knew better. And they had, but on the other hand, they were fully aware, because I was, and who I am, they were fully aware that I was a Vietnam veteran, which was very unusual at the time. And that furthermore, I was a war hero, which was even more unusual. And enormously curious, but I think in part because of their more or less traditional upper Midwest upbringing, and reasonably respectful. You know, I was never called a baby killer. I was never spit on. I mean, just didn't happen. So that piece of the action just never was part of my world. And in fact, I met and started dating a particularly lovely young woman. And I took her to the military ball, and had quite an interesting time there, because I had enlisted in 66 and I had friends who were in RPG. And so I'm back in late 68, early 69, and a bunch of the people that I knew were still in ROTC. They hadn't yet graduated.
Hmm.
And so it comes time for the military ball, and I take the, I have the pictures. And I did the, I didn't have the dress blues thing, but I did the Class A green uniform with the medals, and you wear a white shirt and a bow tie and white gloves, and that's as close to formal wear as probably I was going to get for the military ball. And so there's a receiving line. And, you know, so that you have all the officers of both the Army and Air Force and RTC, then you have the NCOs, and then you have all these cadet types with their chests full of these ersatz medals that make them look like South American generals. And several of them were people that I knew, and they had no idea that I was back, because I had kept kind of a low profile until I'd show up in this receiving line. And, you know, it's sort of the time-honored tradition. As you get introduced to military people, if you're in a dress uniform, the first thing that you do is you look at the boot sound.
Sure.
And it just happened to be the way that my metal bar stacked up, but seven medals on it, and so the bronze star with the B on it is all by itself on the top. got a number of people's attention. And so going through the line, there were some quite open-mouthed responses. But the best one was, because you're being escorted through. And as it turned out, I'm being escorted through by the Sergeant Major from the Army unit. And we're going down through, and we get to one of the people, the guy looks at me, the cadet looks at me and shakes my hand. Homet? Yeah. And he looks at the medal and he said, "Is that real?" And at that point, the Sergeant Major brought him up short.
I bet.
And said, "Son, when you see that medal, that's real. And you respect it. And you don't ask if it's real or not." That was before the days of Stolen Valor. And the young cadet was somewhat flustered at that. I was quite satisfied because I never liked the son of a bitch in the first place. And the woman I was with, the girl I was with, was beaming. And in the fullness of time, I later married her.
So what course of study do you take here at North Dakota State when you finally get things kind of settled down?
I finally get sort of settled down. I ran across a professor named E. James Ubelot. He had been a minister. He got a PhD. He taught interpersonal communication and in a number of ways. If you were to go back and look at it, it was almost like a course in what would have been called in the late 19th and early 20th centuries classical rhetoric. And he taught that in a way that I thought was really good. It was more than speech classes. It was more than how to give a speech. It was, he did a lot of stuff on ethics. He did a lot of stuff on Quintilian's discussion that were, you know, a rhetorician. Was also expected to be a good man, and what is it to be a good man? And that was quite formative for me. And I took to it like a duck to water. I mean, it was like, yeah, this makes perfectly good sense. By that time, that whole scientific discipline stuff had gone away. It has never come back. I have no. When I first entered college, I was going to be a scientist. And by the time I got back to it, it was just not part of the discussion. But, so I followed that up, and it may seem like a useless discipline, but for me it was a big deal, and it has maintained a big deal. I've remembered many of those lessons, and tried to let that, rather than the sort of nature of some of the stuff I was involved in, try to let that guide the course of my life. I'd like to say it's been more or less lessons on how to be a good person are there. And now, they had probably always been there. You read the first chapter of my book. And those are sort of guiding things that matter. So I don't know. I mean, that's what I did. In the meantime, I also became the editor of the student newspaper, which was great fun. And became involved in something that got national, even worldwide press coverage called the Zip to Zap in May of 1969.
Tell me about that.
The previous editor of the paper to me, an Army veteran, upon getting ready to leave, wrote a tongue-in-cheek piece that really comes spring break, this would have been April of 69 or so, that really comes spring break, the other students in the country could all do spring break in things like, you know, Anaheim, California, or Venice, or Fort Lauderdale, and we up here in North Dakota didn't have any place to go, so he made up some stories about how we did have a little paradise in North Dakota called the City of Zap, which is northwest of Bismarck. It's a little coal mining town. 350 people, and so that on spring break, the North Dakota students should go to Zap. He writes this piece, leaves, and the next week I am the editor of the paper. And my phone starts to ring. And rings off the hook. And I'm getting calls from all over the country about these kids saying, yeah, we're going to come to Zap. If you're going to go to Zap, we're going to go to Zap. And it started with the Veterans Club at North Dakota State. Went to the Veterans Club at the University of North Dakota. Went to the Veterans Club at the University of Minnesota. And then it exploded. And then it hit the APA wire and went national. And suddenly I've got people all over the place calling up saying, hey, we're going to come to Zap. And every day it doubles. I mean, it just gets into this sort of logarithmic increase. And so finally the mayor of Zap calls me and says, listen, we understand you're going to come. We're going to have the cowbells, that's the ladies who are involved in the beef industry, and they'll have a little food thing out there, and we'll sell these sort of like meat pasties called Fleischkugel. And we'll have somebody's leased another bar so that the kids can buy beer. We make a big deal out of it. We'll be coming and having a good time. And he said, how many people do you think are coming? And I said, well, I can't know for sure, but right at the moment it feels like around 6,000. And you could hear his jaw drop. And it just went crazy. So I mean, and it's in the news. I mean, I'm doing TV interviews, I'm doing radio interviews, I'm getting calls from all over the country. And people are coming. And I can't stop them. I can't say, no, we're not doing that, because we're doing that. And what we didn't know was that this influx of students was noticed by the then governor of North Dakota, William Guy, who was normally a pretty nice fellow, but I think he was bothered by the fact that there'd be all these drunken students in this little town. So he alerted the National Guard, which was mostly composed of college kids that were trying to avoid service in Vietnam. And he lays on special anti-riot training for them. And so the night of Zap, the night it was supposed to happen, a bunch of kids get into town. It's cold. So they pick up a pile of scrap wood from a building that had been torn down. They build a bonfire. And they're standing around, and memory of this is very clear. A bunch of the folks from the Vets Club got just plastered and were peeing in the fire. And this causes no end of alarm among some of the local constabulary. So they contact the National Guard types, who had been deployed on a hill about 2 miles away. It takes about 4 hours to get them organized so they can go into Zap. Meanwhile, the kids have pretty much done what they're going to do. They're in tents and vans and whatever, and either sleeping it off or getting laid by the time that the National Guard gets there about 6:30 in the morning. If once again, the term clusterfuck comes to mind. The National Guard is told to route these kids and get them out of town, but no one had made a plan for how to get them out of town. So you have all these cars sort of milling around, some of them running into each other, people in blind panic. And the National Guard there with looking like National Guard. And truth be told, as I learned 40 years later at the reunion, a bunch of the people in National Guard said, if we hadn't been on guard duty and been called up that week, we would have been out there partying with your kids. Anyway, the whole thing just was massive. It was the only time that the National Guard was called out about students in North Dakota. Everybody was terribly embarrassed. I thought it was hugely funny. We all went on to our lives. People sort of got the idea that they just would talk about it. Maybe people would forget it, and by and large they did. But it was hugely funny. It turns out that the previous editor, the one who wrote the first story about going to Zap, he later goes to work for the major newspaper in North Dakota, and after that goes to work for then Congressman, later Senator Byron Dorgan, and becomes respectable, and is embarrassed. He's mildly embarrassed about it even now, except that he's. I, on the other hand, am completely reconstructed. I've always thought it was funny. I still think it's funny. If we had to do it again, I would do it again. Oh, okay, let me give you one thing I'd forgotten I would mention. On special leave coming home, mid-December, 67, I get on the plane in, I think it was Tonsonu, and it was like 110, 114 above. I get off the plane less than 36 hours later in Fargo, North Dakota, and it's 36 below. So I get to go through a 150-degree temperature differential in less than 2 days. And walking off the plane, there were no jetways. Remember, I'm walking down the ramp at the rear of 737. I'm walking down the ramp, and the inside of the plane is warm. I walk down the ramp, about halfway down, that cold blast of air hits me. It was like walking into a wall. It was really quite an interesting experience.
Yeah, quite a shift there.
I couldn't breathe. It was hot. So anyway, yeah, I get home, and I think finally what happens, the student movement at that point is, you need to be kind of stupid. Some of the local kids who wanted to be radicals, but they just weren't very good at it, really wanted to be radicals. And in most places, the student newspapers don't help them along, and I didn't. I wasn't absolutely against them. I just made sure that at least I didn't take them seriously because they were not to be taken seriously.
You get your degree in at North Dakota State.
Yep.
What's the, give me a thumbnail sketch of your career.
Well, there is no thumbnail sketch because I didn't have a career.
Hmm.
What I did was, I went from job to job to job. I didn't take it even too terribly seriously. The first thing I did was I went to work at television news. I was a reporter and later news director of Channel 12 in Bismarck, North Dakota. I go back to fired from that when I asked for a raise. I wanted $10,000 a year. Can you imagine? Oh, went back to graduate school. I was going to take a master's in social and behavioral sciences, and did all the classwork, 180 quarter hours of classwork, and was getting set to do the thesis. And in 1974, a weird thing happened. I end up running for the North Dakota State Senate. I was supposed to lose. I thought I would lose. I never thought I would win, and I did.
Hmm.
And so I spent a term in the North Dakota State Senate, which has, you know, marked me for life. As I tell people, I have much to atone for. I have, in fact, committed politics.
I'll be darned.
Yes. So if you want to use an honorific, you will call me Senator.
No, from now on, I certainly will.
No, don't.
I wasn't going to.
Good. But, so I spent a term in the North Dakota State Senate. Came back out of there, went to work, I think, again for the university. One was about 1980 or so. I had run a small nonprofit, United Cerebral Palsy of North Dakota. I put that together with advocacy cooperative for the developmentally disabled. Started charitable gambling in North Dakota. When I discovered the hole in the state statute, they thought they had written it only for the knife and fork clubs and the veterans clubs, and they hadn't. So my organization dealt the first legal hand of public blackjack at a bar in the entire state. It's now everywhere. Went to work in Minnesota. My marriage broke up. One thing led to another. I went to work in Minnesota, to Grand Rapids, for a community action agency, which was in dire financial straits, and fixed it. But the person who fixes the problem is not the one who gets to run the show afterwards. So left that, and ran a congressional campaign in 1986. Candidate in Minnesota. win, but he came awful damn close, 121 votes, with the National Democratic Party working against him at the time because they didn't think he had a chance of coming. And in the meantime, I had met this other young lady that I was quite enamored of, and she came out to Oregon here to go to law school. I stayed behind and did that campaign, and then came out to Oregon because I discovered I was much happier where she was than where she wasn't. And I signed up to go to graduate school again and got an MBA. And she got a law degree, so she has been working for the state Oregon Department of Justice. She's now very senior and very well respected. I've kept doing a bunch of other project stuff, mostly political campaigns here and there, for which I was paid handsomely. And finally decided I was through with all that, so when I was 59, I retired. Didn't need the money. My wife was doing well. I had enough from investments and properties and stuff like that. But my wife said this absolutely most loving thing I can imagine saying to a husband. She said, "You know, you're a much more interesting person when you're not working for idiots." I said, "Well, you know, that's a nice thing to know." So basically, I just retired and managed properties for a while. And I've been retired since. As careers go, it's pretty spotty. I am told that may be a product of PTSD. I don't know that that's true, but it might be. If it is, so what?
Well, let me take you back to the times after Vietnam, after coming home. Did you keep up with the war at all once you got back?
Yeah, but there was one incident that you probably should know about because I did put it. It's like 3 days after I get back, I run across my old scoutmaster. Nice man. He is just effusive. "I'm so proud of you, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I want you to put on your Class A uniform and come down and meet the boys at the American Legion." Okay, how are you going to tell your scoutmaster no? So I did that, and got to the American Legion Hall at 2:30, 3 o'clock. And here are these World War II vets, Greatest Generation types. And it's 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they're pretty well in their cups. He introduces me around, is terribly proud, look at him, he's a war hero, and of course, you know, 1 in 15 World War II vets in Europe heard a shot being fired. 1 in 12 in the Pacific. Everybody else was rear. They were doing supply and support and all that sort of good stuff. But that's what really happened. So statistically, these guys haven't seen much. But all of them won the Battle of the Bulge, or personally climbed Mount Suribachi. And I'm just sort of taking it all in. But I'm trying to be polite, because that's World War II, and they won, and that's good. And my war is still going on, and I know about it, but I'm out of it, and I'm not going back to it. And then it begins. "Well, you guys have it easy." "Yeah, when in my war, by God, when we signed up, we were in for the duration, and we weren't going to get out after a year, and you have all of these supplies, and you didn't have to go hungry, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da." Yeah, okay, fine, you know that. If you're dealing with a bunch of drunks, what the hell? But keep in mind, this is 1968. These people are all in their 40s and 50s. They're old enough to know better. They're by no means old geezers. And they're running the damn country. They're running all the companies, they're running the government, they're doing everything. This is the Greatest Generation, you know, on the line. And then it starts and gets worse. "Well, if we had been there, by God, that war would have been over in 2 weeks. That was the part where I started to become offended. And I still didn't say anything. And they went on at length. At length. "Well, you guys aren't half the soldiers we were at the time." And I found a reason to leave. And so my scoutmaster had made some lame excuse. you know, he's one of these sort of Kiwanis types. So, Don, when can we sign you up for an American Legion card? I looked him straight in the eye and said, when the hell freezes over. What? He was gobsmacked. He could not believe it. I said, I am deeply, deeply, deeply offended. You know, however that war is being fought, it's not our fault. And however well you guys did, that's not their fault. We all went there, we all did what we were told, we were all in, you know, followed the instructions as best we could, and whatever happens in this war, you know, I take no particular pride in it, and whatever happened in that war, I can guarantee you that I know better than these guys, you know, who fundamentally claim that they won it all by themselves. So if I never see this group of assholes again, it'll be too soon, and I apologize, I said I'm sorry, but, you know, you go back and tell your guys, you have deeply offended a veteran of this war. And this war is not like their war. And as I learned later on when I was doing some counseling with the vet centers, the people who treated the Vietnam veterans worst, were the World War II vets. I am not one of those who buys into Tom Brokaw's thing about the greatest generation. These people were real assholes. They compared us to them. There was no comparison to be made because the war wasn't the same. But they were doing the hiring. They were running the country. They were running the government. There's a reason why the GI Bill for Vietnam vets is nowhere near as good as it was for the World War II time. And so I am one of those probably rare people who sees it, what I think, clearly, and who is not as enamored of the greatest generation as perhaps Tom Brokaw was. But that's because Tom Brokaw never had to deal with it. Tom Brokaw could say things about his father. And should. And that's fine. And yeah, they won their war. They saved the world. But they thought they should get credit for it, and I don't think they should. That was a total kind of thing. And those of us who were in Vietnam, man, 60,000 people who aren't here, who did their level damnedest to do as much and as best as they could, and it wasn't their fault that no one ever knew what it was when it was ever going to be. If you were in World War II, no one had any idea what it was going to be again, as McNamara told us later. So, there you go. That's the worst thing I have to say about that whole experience. Am I better? Yeah, I am. And am I angry? Yeah, I'm still angry about that. Do I take it out on them? No, I would never do that. I am enormously respectful every time I see the old geezers now, some with canes, some in wheelchairs with their World War II veteran hats on. And I wish them all the good in the world. But I have forgotten how those people treated us. And by the way, I'm not the only Vietnam veteran. There's something for you to
do. Well, I'm glad you're able to get that on the record as well. What you experienced certainly was certainly not unique.
No, it wasn't unique, and that's the story that has yet to be told. The fact is, it wasn't unique. It was common. And when I talked to friends of mine, there's a guy who lives in Colorado Springs, retired as a lieutenant colonel out of the Army. Another war hero who was at Fulloy, by the way, after I was. But he had the same thing happen, and he was a goddamn lieutenant colonel, and got the same sort of treatment. You know, we were all mildly crazy. We were all drug-addicted fiends. We were all, whatever it was. We had it easy. We should have fought harder. Well, fuck you! Sorry. But, I just don't need to deal with it.
Yeah.
Okay, I've said my piece.
What do you think about that? In a different sense, I guess. The impression that the public has had of the Vietnam veteran over the years. Because it's changed.
It has. But that's because most of the people who were problems have died. The guys who came back, like they came back from World War II. I mean, there were plenty of PTSD types from World War II. They became alcoholics. Okay? And they died. the motorcycle gangs, the Hells Angels that people talk about. That's those guys. But nobody ever deals with that sort of thing as saying that the war caused them some kind of deal. And there was that whole, you know, when you came home, you came as a unit, and you came back, and you were given a parade, and you were told to feel proud, and all that sort of good stuff. And, you know, and for a while, veterans' preference actually meant something, so they could get jobs. Well, there were jobs to be had. The world was trying to rebuild, and this country was going to rebuild it, and it did, and those people were hired, and they were sent to school, and probably the best goddamn social program, you know, sponsored by government that this nation has ever seen, the education of the World War II vets, who, by and large, if had it not been for the war, would have remained a bunch of ignorant manual laborers. They would not have gone to where they got to. That much I am absolutely convinced of. Vietnam vets came back, and early on, it was kind of like, we're here. But nobody came back as a unit. Units didn't come back. From Iraq and Afghanistan, units come back. We have these demobilization ceremonies now. But we came back one at a time. We sort of dribbled in. And yeah, some of them got into problems. And every damn time there was a problem with drugs, or something happened, or somebody had a psychotic episode, which, by the way, a bunch of them richly deserved. Vietnam veteran. And so we were looked upon as mildly crazy. I've had some of that. Oh, you're a Vietnam vet. Yeah. Well, you know, one of those kind of deals. Do I care? Not particularly. But did I know people who suffered from that terribly? Yeah, I did. The vet centers from the 1970s, those kids coming through that, man, they were totally unprepared, and there was no one to help them. And even those that wanted to help them, they wouldn't talk to them. At the vet centers, for example, I was called a peer counselor. And the only reason I was there, I'm not a trained counselor, I don't do counseling, but I was there. They would talk to me. They would not talk to the professional counseling types. But the professional counseling types hadn't been there. And the returning vets said, you weren't there. You don't know. And they were right. So they would talk to me. The counselors would listen. And then in the fullness of time, you know, something would happen. But did they survive? No. There's a poem by a guy from an Oregonian, in fact, by a guy from Nashville. I can't remember the guy's name, but the poem is called The Wall Within. It's the best piece of literature to come out of the whole Vietnam experience. I commend it to you. It's enormously powerful and spot on. It talks about the turmoil and torment. When the wall opened in D.C., there was a group of people, Vietnam veterans, in the woods, in the perimeter, standing way away from it. They didn't feel comfortable being within their crowd of normal people. But they were there. They're still there. You still find them. Go there at 9 o'clock at night. And I've even had some people say, well, why are you whining? Not whining. I led a pretty good life. I had it easy. I was always going to have it easy, and I always knew that. I can tell you that my Vietnam service is probably one of the least important things that ever happened to me in my life. Being married to two really quite nice women is much better. Being as involved in my community is much better in terms of overall significance. Yeah, it happened. Proud of what I did? Yeah, I am, in a way. I regret and will regret to my dying day that I have regretted. Does that make any sense? you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I mean, does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, sure. I mean,
it's hard to put it all into words. Was I discriminated against? Not overtly, but was it there? It's always been. It's still there. And in fact, I've used it every now and then. On one occasion, there was a young man who, because of my wife's position, the Department of Justice was acting like he was a threatener. And I said, you know, if anything happens to that lady, start watching your watch because you don't have long. He said, is that a threat? I said, oh, yeah, it is. And he said, well, what makes you think you'd get away with it? Oh, I said, I know exactly what to do. I point out that I'm a Vietnam veteran and I have a flashback. And you know how crazy we can be. I wouldn't have done a damn thing to him, but by God, he bought into it. So that's out there, and it's been out there. And the reason why Vietnam veterans are more respected now than then is because the ones that people were bothered about are mostly dead. Sorry.
One last question for you, Don. As you look back on the Vietnam experience, everything that it was, and to some degree, everything that it continues to be. What do you think is the lasting historical legacy of the Vietnam War? What does the Vietnam War mean?
What does it mean? Oh, God. There is not an answer. There are answers on many different levels. And it sort of depends on where you want to take it. Militarily. It's always good to know what war you're fighting. And during Vietnam, now reasonably clear to me as it was, as it has been to others, I'm not alone in this. Whatever war it was we were fighting, whatever it was our generals, particularly West Borman, thought they were doing, that wasn't the war we were fighting. We were fighting a different war against a different enemy. What is it to win? What do you win when you win? Does that mean you merely put down an enemy army or a military force for a while? No. It does not. We knew what it was to win in World War II because basically Germany surrendered. Since then, nobody has. I think that's important. What sort of war do you fight when you face an enemy that's not about to surrender? Basically, at that point, you're talking about war without end, amen. You got to say something about treatment of the veterans. You just have to do that. We send these people into harm's way in our name. We best know why we didn't do that. And so we invented a reason. Worse, it was wrong. That was not a war we ever should have fought. And had we known then what we know now back in 1948 when Ho Chi Minh asked that the French not take his country back, Harry S. Truman should have said, fine, it's yours. And Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles should have let the reunification election go forward, and they didn't. Because they were intent on fighting godless atheistic communism, as it turned out, a lot of the people at the time wanted us to do. People forget that we went into Vietnam with banners, you know, flags, banners flying, and oh yeah, this was going to be great, and it was going to be wonderful, and it would be over in no time. And boy, we couldn't have been much more wrong. So that's important. And how do you take care of the veterans when they come back? Does it occur to you that nobody, what was it, Clint Eastwood said at the end of The Outlaw Josie Wales, well, yeah, a lot of us died a little in that damn war. There were 60,000 that are on the wall. There are thousands more elsewhere. And there are thousands more out here who are still scarred. I don't know that we can ever be restored to the status quo. bear that experience, and as much as we try to put a brave face on it. When you get people in a quiet time in a quiet place, and it's only the Vietnam vets talking with each other, they don't think of me too much. They're not, you know, they're not ones to talk about how heroic they were. Those are some lessons. The question is, do the lessons get applied? The answer I fear is no. We've been engaged in a couple of other wars, Middle East, in which the reason, the rationale for them, were also concocted against an enemy that would not surrender and is not about to surrender. We're not going to win in what people. Veterans come back. They come back somewhat differently than we did. They still don't have a decent GI Bill that they should. They still don't have a decent VA that will take proper care of them that they should. We still don't have the kind of counseling services for them and their families that they should. And now, rather than 60,000 dead, there's 5,000. But those 5,000. So I try to, you know, at some point the lesson is personal. You know, what am I going to do? I have gone out of my way every chance I've had to try to support the Iraq-Afghanistan vets. And in point of fact, there's an organization, the Vietnam Veterans of America. And its founding motto was, never again will one generation of veterans abandon. What generation of Americans we Vietnam veterans felt abandoned by? And so I try as much as I can at a personal level, since I don't deal with public policy, at a personal level to tell the Iraq types, hey, so probably more than you want to know, but it's what I know.
No, that's terrific, and I'm glad you were able to share that. Again, you're not certainly not alone with your thoughts on this. Donna, is there anything else that you'd like to add to the interview before we bring it to a close?
Well, I've held forth probably more than I probably should have.
Certainly not.
But, no, not really. I mean, you know, shit happens. It happens. People ask me, what do you think? And my answer is as I gave to you. I'm enormously proud of what I did and what my guys did. I regret that any of there's a very deep and profound lesson in there somewhere, and I don't quite know how to say it in any other way, because I don't think our language has the concept of what it's doing.
All right, well, I'll go ahead and put an end to the interview then. Thank you very much.